Kelly Krager conducting an oral history interview with Ms. Kate Johnson. Today is 29 November 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas on the campus of Texas Tech University, and Ms. Johnson is joining me by telephone from Redwood Shores, California. Ms. Johnson, to begin the interview, I'd like to find out a little bit about your background. Can you tell me when and where you were born?
I was born in Southern California in 1942. I'm an only child. My parents had come from the panhandle strip of Oklahoma a year or two before I was born. And I would call them kind of dysfunctional. So as I grew up as an only child, I had a horse at the age of nine, and I spent all my time with my horse, and I was always horse crazy from the very beginning.
So what did your folks do up there in the panhandle or in Southern California when they moved?
My mother was in a family of five children, four daughters and a son that finally came along. And they were born and living in Boise City, Oklahoma, right in the tip of the panhandle in Cimarron County. It's kind of farming, dry farming, mm-hmm. and a lot of ranches out there. My grandfather, though, was in the insurance agency, so he was not a farmer. And they were probably kind of the upper class of the town, for what that's worth. My mother was 16 when the first day of the Dust Bowl hit, so both of my parents lived through the Dust Bowl.
Oh my goodness. Did they ever tell you about those experiences? It must have been something.
They never talked about it when I was a kid. And with Ken Burns' documentations and stuff, I finally began to hear about it and began to question them about it. And yeah, they remember taping the windows and wearing masks. And did any of your friends die of dust pneumonia? Well, yeah, one or two.
Wow.
I don't know, but they never wanted to talk about it. I guess it was just so awful they didn't care to talk about it.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't even know about it as an adult until I was, well along in midlife.
Wow.
My mother was still around, and we showed her the Ken Burns document. And, oh, I know him. Too bad he didn't interview her because she was still lucid at that point.
Yeah.
She died 2 years ago at the age of 98.
Well, what about your father? What did he do? Yeah.
He was also in a family of five. There were three boys and two girls. And all of them except one who was very religious was an alcoholic as an adult. And he was a violent alcoholic, which made him very difficult to live with. And I was the referee, which made the dysfunctional part of my life. He worked for the railroad as a young man. When he came to California, he ended up working for the Santa Fe Railroad also. He said he started at Berkeley, but I don't know that that ever really happened. So I think I was the first person on his side of the family to go to college, and probably the second on my mother's side.
So growing up in Southern California, what was it like to grow up in Southern Cal in the 50s, early 60s?
Well, in San Bernardino, San Bernardino has mountains on three sides, and the opening part of the horseshoe is aimed toward L.A. And L.A. was having very bad smog at that point. And during high school, I'd wake up in the morning and look off to the west, and I would see kind of a brown, lower part of the sky was just all brown. By the time I got home from school at 2 and 3 o'clock in the afternoon, that had moved into the San Bernardino Valley, into the horseshoe. And you couldn't see more than maybe a mile. It was just horrible, horrible smog. And that cleared up, I guess, only 10, 20 years later. It got better. But there for a while, it was just really, really smoggy. And even after I moved up to Northern California, which was in 1972, I remember going back, flying from the L.A. area back to San Francisco, and there was smog all the way up the coast. It never quite parted between the two large areas. I guess with all the automobile exhaust regulations and so forth, they really cleared up most of that. So it's much better now than it was. This would have been in the 60s when I was in high school. Well, 50s, late 50s and when I was in high school. And then in the 60s, it was still pretty bad down there, but I wasn't living there at that time.
What sort of things did you like to do as a kid growing up in Southern Cal?
Well, I lived my life on my horse. My horse was my best friend, my horse and join my friends. We'd go down to the dairy and flirt with the boys and eat ice cream that we got for free. That was almost a nightly event. For a while, my horse was in the backyard until development came too close and we had to move it. Then it was across the street, and we boarded my horse at Dr. Lansing's place. He had probably 20, 30 acres of pasture land and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
And he had a daughter slightly younger than me, but she was a fast developer, and I was a slow developer, so we hit it off. And did a lot of riding, and I guess they decided I was good influence on her, so they just kind of adopted me into their family and took me everywhere. And Dr. Lansing was quite colorful. He was a tenor during college and a carpenter as a young man, and put himself through med school and became a doctor. And he decided he wanted to travel all the John Muir Trail by horseback. And he had done backpacking in the Tetons as a young man, so he was experienced with that.
Mm-hmm.
And he spent 3 summers doing the John Muir Trail, doing 125 miles each summer. And the first 2 summers I went with them. The 3rd summer I was getting ready for college, so I didn't go. But I was in paradise. My friend Carla, his daughter, she read a book most of the time called John Muir Horse. No big deal to her.
That must have been an incredible experience.
Oh, it was.
Yeah.
It was a great experience. We took our own horses up, and then, of course, we had pack mules and so forth, and packed in. But, the 2nd summer, we almost had a tragedy going over Mount Whitney on the switchback. We had the mules ahead of the horses, which you shouldn't do. And one of the mules knocked a big boulder down, and it hit the horse in front of him and knocked its back end off the trail, and it scrambled and got back on. And the drop-off was about 3,000 feet there, or I've been forever down onto a glacier. So if we'd lost that horse and the little 9-year-old girl on it, it would have been a real tragedy.
Isn't that something?
And then also, that same horse, I think it was that same horse, when he turned out the pasture one night, Dr. Lansing's favorite little horse, little black thoroughbred, just as obvious to me, and she ran up and bit that horse in the rear end, and the horse kicked her and knocked her down. And Carla and I were turning the horses loose from pasture, so we saw all of this. And anyway, all of our medication that we had with us went to the horse, and the horse, I walked it until like midnight to keep it on its feet. But, and Dr. Lansing came out and said, "How's she doing?" I said, "Well, so-so." So I guess he took her over and tied her up, and shortly after that she died. And all of the men who were there dug her grave out from under her, I guess, because you can't move a horse very easily.
Mm-hmm.
So by morning, when the girls, there were 3 or 4 of us, woke up and the horse was gone. That was his favorite polo horse.
Isn't that a shame?
Look, nobody else liked her because she was so ornery, and she would bite people. She was quite a fighter. Very off the track.
That's all right, though. What about schooling? Where did you go to school? What kind of student were you?
I was a very hard-working student. Not quite sure what. We started out kind of in a ghetto school, and in 6th grade, even at the other end of town, and all of a sudden I was going to school with smart kids and realized how far behind I was.
Hmm.
Prior to that, I had been like the best student in the class. Maybe 1 or 2 of us were the best students. All the rest were just kind of hanging in there. In the new school, I was way behind. We went to junior high school. For some reason, I was segregated and put with a college prep group. And then I was really felt lost because I was so far behind all the kids. And I was a very quiet kid to begin with. I was raised to be seen and not heard.
Mm-hmm.
And no matter what you said to my father, he would start an argument, so you just pretty much kept quiet. So being very, very shy and timid and working very hard, by 8th grade I think I finally was holding my own, and by 9th grade I was doing okay. And in high school, I was still in that college prep group, and they worked us really hard. But I was a good student. I graduated with a scholarship. I always said I wanted to major in commercial art. And one of the field trips we took in high school was in the Pasadena to an art school. And I looked at the students there, and I was going through a very religious phase, and thought, well, which of those students do I want to live with while I'm going to school here? And the answer was none of them. They were a little too free-spirited. So I went back and talked to my music teacher, my choir teacher at high school, and said, well, where can I go for music and art? And he pretty much my San Diego State University. It was a state college at that time. It's a university now. So I did, and I was accepted there. So I went to college in San Diego.
Now, did you always know that you wanted to go to college? You mentioned that you were put in these college prep classes. Was that something
that
was...
Yes, I did.
Yeah?
I probably knew from about the age of 9. I was unhappy at home with my parents.
Mm-hmm.
And my mother would not leave my father because she didn't want to be a divorced woman, which was a very bad thing in those days.
Sure.
And even though she had gone to work when I was 4 and a half, she didn't think she was earning enough money to support the two of us. And my father made good money, but he rarely got home with it. Because he'd get drunk on the way home and somebody get all his money. I decided about the age of 9 that I wanted to be financially independent. I didn't want any man ever telling me what to do.
Yeah.
And having the first thing. So I had to have free room and board because I couldn't survive on my own. So I definitely wanted to go to college.
Hmm.
And I definitely wanted to get out of college and get a job and be totally independent and be free to make my own decisions. That hasn't worked out real well, but...
Well, when did you graduate high school? It's been, what, 1960, I guess?
1960.
Yeah.
I graduated in 1964 and took a teaching job because the only jobs available back in those days, secretary, airline stewardess, if you were drop-dead gorgeous, nurse, or a teacher. If you had a college degree, nurse or teacher. If you didn't have a college degree, maybe secretary.
Mm-hmm.
Or if you're gorgeous, airline stewardess.
Yeah.
And those are about the only jobs that were really offered. Well, I ended up majoring in music. I didn't know until the day I actually registered whether it's going to be a declared music major or an art major. But I found out I could major in music and be an organ student and learn pipe organ, which, because I was in a religious faith, thought that was pretty cool. And I didn't play the piano well enough that I would really make it as a piano student. I wasn't really that gifted musically.
Mm.
So anyway, I went into music education. So when I get out of college, I can teach music. And I did that. I got a job out of college in Claremont, near about 30 miles out of L.A., and taught 2 years there and then received a full fellowship to go to graduate school there. So I took, and meanwhile, I got married and divorced. 2-year marriage. It was kind of a disaster.
Hmm. Well, let me back up here a little bit, if you don't mind, Kay.
Sure.
You mentioned that you graduated high school in 1960 before you moved on to San Diego State. As a teenager, how aware were you of what was going on in the country? What was your awareness of what's going on in the world? You know, we've got civil rights brewing. We've got the Cold War going on. What sort of things do you remember as the kind of the background to your life as a teenager?
Very little. I was really on survival mode through most of those early years. And I was just struggling to survive and get ahead and outlive my parents. Things were so bad at home that in my junior year, I came down with mononucleosis because I wasn't getting any sleep.
Hmm.
My dad would come home after the bars closed and be 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning. And then they'd have the big brawl, and I'd have to get up and call the police or, you know, play that game.
Wow.
And
that's difficult for a kid.
Yeah, I was the adult and they were the kids. Of course, my homework was tough enough if I was in these college prep classes, but I was sometimes up until midnight just doing homework. Because I had to ride my horse, of course, in the day. And I also was taking piano lessons and had to practice. So I was sick for 6 months.
Mm.
And only. But the worst case my doctor said he'd ever seen of mononucleosis. That's a stress-related disease.
Yeah.
So as far as my awareness of politics or anything, since we didn't have discussions at home, and I never had people over because I couldn't, it's very limited.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you mentioned, that going away to school would be kind of a relief from a lot of this.
It was paradise. I was in heaven in college. I loved it.
Well, tell me about that, if you would. Tell me, what was life like at San Diego State in the early 1960s? Tell me about the environment. Tell me about your classes. Give me that experience.
San Diego is known as a party school. It was relatively easy to get into. So we had lots of fraternities on campus, and some of them were known to start their drinking maybe Friday morning and skip their classes on Friday and then party all weekend and be too sick to go to school on Monday. So they went ahead and take the week. Again, I worked very hard. I found a had best friend who was a roommate for part of the time. And she was an organizer as well. And we get up very early in the morning, so the music building and practice organ. And we had an electric one, a pipe organ, and we would go back and forth. And we'd be there early enough before all the other students were, so we wouldn't have to fight for practice time. And I got mostly A's in my music classes and B's and C's in other classes. I really enjoyed biology. My reading skills were not great enough, so I would have done really well in something like English Lit. And I was too shy to be into drama. So music was the perfect place for me. We had about 250 music students. The music department was just a regular big family. And all of us had to perform at least once a semester. And we watched all the students grow. And it was a really pleasant place to be. And when I met my little friend, Gail, she was the organ teacher. She introduced me to her teacher. She was the organ student. She introduced me to her teacher. And he kind of became a mentor, a substitute father. And he really mentored the two of us. And it was because of him, actually, and his contacts, that I got my first teaching job. So San Diego was very pleasant to me. I really enjoyed my time there.
Yeah. You don't very often.
President Kennedy came and spoke there, flew in with three helicopters, and he filled up the football field, and he made a speech there. And I guess it was about a year later when he was assassinated, and I had been down in the microfiche basement all day long. It came out, and the campus was just strange. I walked by classes and was kind of around, and people crossed. It was just very, very strange, and I finally heard what had happened. So that was a big event on the campus.
What did you think about Kennedy in general?
I thought he was great. He was heroic as far as we were concerned. Of course, because he came to San Diego, we all loved him. Politically, did I have any real critiquing abilities? Not really, because I didn't have a political background in any way. My parents were not politically involved, other than they always voted. But there were no conversations about who they were voting for or anything at home. But I guess I wasn't home. I was gone as much as possible. On weekends, I was on my horse and gone. I had a secret hideout up in the mountains and a couple of hills. And for many years, I would ride up to Arrowhead Spring Stables. It was about 10 miles by trail. I could look at it an hour on my little horse. And I'd stay up there all day on Saturday, ride home, go back on Sunday. That kind of thing. So I was not home that much.
Yeah. Well, again, it's a very difficult position for a teenage girl to be in, or anyone to be in.
Yeah.
You mentioned Kennedy's assassination. What kind of impact did that have on you, and what kind of impact do you think it's had on the country ever since?
I'm not sure the impact it had on me. Coming out of a survival mode situation, and I had been through war zone at home for years, which I did very well for me now, I have to say. After college, I taught for 2 years in San Diego, and one of my roommates had been very politically involved. She had gone to Washington for a whole year and worked as a pager or whatever they do there. And Bobby Kennedy was running for election and doing his campaigning in Southern California. And I was with her when she got the news that he had been killed. And she was just hysterical. So she was really for Kennedy, very strongly involved in all of that. And probably through her is probably the most influence that I really... And I was just so really non-political. Trying to get my own life together.
Yeah, I guess you would have been teaching at this time when Bobby Kennedy was killed. Yeah.
Yes.
What did you think of teaching? You graduated in 1964. What did you think of life as a teacher?
Teaching was not really the thing I wanted to do. I'm Robert's only child. I've not really been around children. I was praised for my teaching abilities, but I found it difficult. My first teaching job was at junior high level, and kind of a mill for teachers. It was in Claremont. We had 7 period days. I had 5 general music classes and 1 choir, and the classes rotated so that you saw them 4 times a week. We were on a trimester system. My teaching load was 215 students. And we had midterm grades, and we had the grade cards. It's not, you were doing paperwork all the time.
Mm-hmm.
And it was just really a difficult situation. And of course, I was very shy still. And within those 2 years, probably overcame most of my shyness. But I can't say that I enjoyed most of my teaching because there were so many discipline problems. And intermediate school, they also had to have a homogeneous grouping. There were 5 different groups. And the top 2 were just wonderful kids. And the top group I had, Kate Diamond was in it. Her father was an international politician, quite famous. And the Bottoms kid, Timothy Bottoms, was in that class.
Oh, no kidding.
I had him in my music class.
Hmm.
He became quite a well-known music star. He and his brother both, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
So I had just some wonderful kids, and I realized that they already had a lot of musical training, most of them, or at least knew about it. And so one day I said, what would you like to do in this class? And we wanted to do a musical. And so I said, okay, on Friday we'll have auditions for a musical. And come and try to convince the class, we'll vote. Whatever you vote on, we'll do. And the 2 strongest ones were Kate Diamond, and he wanted to do Taming of the Shrew, and Robert, I think his name at the moment, I can never forget these kids, Robert, anyway, he wanted to do Music Camp, and he got in front of the class, and he did the train scene. They got to know the territory, sang the song, jumped up and down, tried to do all the different parts, it was just unreal. Kate Diamond did a pretty good presentation, too. And so the kids voted on that. We did Music Man. But that class was really phenomenal. And those kids, I could say, okay, the dancing group out this, and I was in a band room that had no windows. Put the dancers out here, you folks go over there and rehearse your part. I could send them in all different directions and put somebody in charge. And you know, they'd come back at the right time and it would be done. There were no discipline, well, there were 2 discipline problems there. But they were kind of funny ones. Lance Little was a discipline problem. He was a little guy with a great big bass voice. And quite a comedian as well. And I had one other one that just was kind of obstinate. And he had the part of the train conductor. And he was supposed to walk through. And he got scared backstage and couldn't get into on stage. But anyway, and he was very obstinate for the very last couple of rehearsals on the play. And finally he came around. Very interesting. So anyway, I had some good times with the bottom kids. That was awful. One of them ran in one day. Lou Johnson, all the guys are chasing me. All the boys are chasing me out there. Can I stay in here at Safest? And so she came into class early, and when the bell rang and the kids all came in, they came in just throwing all kinds of smut at her.
Hmm.
And I did report it to the vice principal. Like, well, you know, she's kind of the kid in the school. And she was living with her married 16-year-old sister.
Oh, wow.
Locally, and had flea bites all over her, so her house had been full of fleas. And she was treated terribly, but they said, well, you know, she kind of asked for it. But so that was the other extreme, and I found that very difficult to deal with.
Yeah.
Emotionally, what do you do with these kids? And then, of course, I went to a year of grad school, and then when I was reading, started teaching again, I went to San Diego.
Now, where did you go to grad school?
Oh, right there in Claremont.
Okay, oh, right. You mentioned that, yeah.
Yeah.
And what were you getting your degree in there, just an advanced degree in music?
Oh, music history.
Music mm-hmm. history this time, okay.
Couldn't play well enough to to do a music performing. Well, music history was kind of the other alternative.
Mm.
That was academic, so I was able to do that. undergraduate thesis and so forth. But again, my teacher from San Diego, he was working on his PhD there and had been, in fact, he had been a teacher there, married a student at Pomona College, and she died like a year or two into the marriage. And at that point, he just kind of quit teaching and went off and joined the service and kind of fell apart, I guess. But he was going back there to get his PhD and introduced me. In fact, during the summer, I would take lessons from his teacher. They had lots of interesting things that went on during the summer at those campuses. At the same campus where Pomona and Scripps and Hardy and Mudd is there now. Fairmont Men's College is there now at Fairmont McKenna.
Right.
Sounds like you're familiar with them.
Oh, not too terribly familiar, but certainly know the names and things. What was the environment like there? Because we're talking about the, you know, mid to late 1960s. This is, the Vietnam War is ramping up. Was there any sort of protest, any sort of gathering, any sort of anything like that?
Did not see any.
Yeah.
I was going full time about 1966. For that 1 year.
Mm-hmm.
That campus was very strange. I was coming from the party school of San Diego where no cell groceries on Friday and didn't calm down again until Tuesday. For some students, I wasn't one of those. And I did not join the fraternity, well, except for Sigma Alpha Theta, which is a music fraternity for women. Fairmont College campus is very, very different. A lot of those students had tried to get into Stanford and didn't get in, and it was kind of the next step down.
Mm-hmm.
But they were all private schools, very expensive. Most of the East Coast kids there, you know, the East Coast comes west. And when they had Easter or Christmas or holidays, they were all gone. They all flew home. And during the week, it was a dry town. There was no alcohol sold within the city of Claremont. Those kids studied. They were not social. So I did not find a social life there at all. It was very academic. And I was on the graduate, what they call it, board, representing the music department. And even and those students were very academic, brilliant students, though. So I enjoyed that also because I saw the other side of a really academic college. They were beautiful campuses, of course. However, I was going through my divorce with them during that year, so emotionally I was not having an easy time of it.
Yeah.
But academically, I was able to survive that and move on with my life.
And did you finish up in, I guess, 67?
I finished that year, everything except my orals and my thesis, and I went back the next summer and finished that off and got my degree.
Okay. So what were you...
I had been like the perfect kid. My parents always said, "Oh, if you're so easy, you know, you don't have to worry about it if he does everything right." Which I did. At one time, I was mad, angry at my parents, and I decided to do something mean to them. And I don't recall what it was. But after they found out that I had done this horrible thing, they said, "Oh, why did you do that?" Which made me realize that they didn't care. And I had gone through quite a few pulling the hair. Because I didn't feel good about doing what I had done, whatever it was. And the lesson I learned was, when you do something mean and hungry, it doesn't hurt anybody more than you. So that's a lot. I mean, you're the one that gets hurt. Nobody else really deals with as much as you do.
Yeah.
So it didn't pay off to be intentionally mean and hungry.
How did
I get off on that
tangent? No, that's quite all right. I think we've all been through that at least once, if not multiple times. What did you hope to do with your degree, your master's degree?
I had my master's degree, so I went home for the summer because I didn't have any money. I hadn't been working for a year other than church organist and choir director. I went home for the summer, and I had a job lined up in back in San Diego. I thought that was just, you know, San Diego is a fun place for a young woman to be.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought that would be fun. And, So they called me and said, "Would you like to teach summer school?" And I jumped at the chance, of course. So I signed up for a class at San Diego State. So I could live in the dorms and spend all my money on the dorms and the class I was taking.
Hmm.
And the school didn't pay me for the summer school job until the end of summer school. So I kind of had a free ride in the dorm. I had my room and board handled, and so this kind of stayed by. But it was pretty lean time. And so anyway, I went back to teaching, taught for another 2 years, and this time I had a fourth grade assignment, and I had the music for the school. And the choir was made up of fifth and sixth graders. I did that for 2 years. The first year there, they split the fourth grade into three parts, and the two other teachers who were there took the good kids and the middle kids, and I got the other ones.
Mm-hmm.
And what I pretty much had was 35 special ed kids in one room. And it was a hellacious year. I just had, ridiculous stuff going on all the time. And just too many special ed kids for one person to really, that they weren't all special ed kids, but the one bright student I had in there was hyperactive. He had a spring in his rear end. He just could not sit in a seat. He was just all over the place all the time. And then I had other kids with just all kinds of problems in there to deal with. So that was not a very fun year. And the second year, it was a bit better. And of course, I had the choir going, and the choir was doing good things. We won some contests and various things, so the school was very happy about that. And I told them when I took the choir, I said, I do not want to deal with any discipline problems. So I want another teacher in there, and all I have to do is point at a student who's not behaving, and he's gone. And so I had 120 little kids in this choir, and they were perfectly behaved. I only had to pick out one. And of course, my class was being covered by another teacher during that time.
Mm.
So that was a good experience, but I realized in the second year that teaching isn't something I really want to do. I didn't really want to work with kids. I wanted to work with adults. So I took a mental health day and went back to San Diego State to their employment office and went through all their records to see what a liberal arts major could do with their life. And the only really interesting thing that popped out of that was special services with the U.S. Army.
Hmm. Did you know anything about this?
Pardon?
I'm sorry, did you know anything about special services up to this time?
Not really. There was one gal that was a year or two older than I was that was in the music department, and I remembered that she was going to Vietnam, and she was very happy about that, and she was going to do something musical. So that was probably what that was.
Mm-hmm.
And so I thought, people are doing it. But anyway, so I thought, what the heck, I'll just go ahead and do the applications and fill it out and so forth. And the GUP was very thorough. All of the people that I told gave names to give recommendations for me, and they called every single one of them. They contacted them, and I thought that was interesting. And I guess there's all kinds of security I had to go through, but it's like about 8 months or so of all that paperwork to be done, and it was just reams and reams of paperwork. But in the meantime, my social life was that we had all the young women at that time were having a great time at NCRD in San Diego because of all the men going through there. And, Wednesday night was Admiral Kidd's Club, and Thursday night was NCRD, Friday night was the real NCRD, where there might be 500 people there, and it's an officers' club, so all these young men had college degrees from the best colleges all over the states, and most of them were single, and it was good pickings, fun time.
Right.
Saturday night was date night. We didn't have a date. We were ready to jump off the bridge. We had sailed the entire week. Sunday was on the beach at the Downwinds on Coronado Island. That was just kind of a beer brawl, and then we'd all go to dinner afterwards. Tons of good fun, very easy to meet people. And in the second year, I did meet one gentleman that I thought highly of. And he was dating at least one other woman that I knew about. And he went overseas. His wife, Black Horse. Black Horse is... Anyway, they were propeller planes. He had done a lot of flying with some military families. And I thought, well, maybe if I were there, I could. And by this time, I guess I knew I had been selected. I found out after he had gone over. And so I thought, well, maybe if I got over there and we could get together a few times, we could, at least the other woman would not be there. Maybe we could get things resolved. And so that was part of my reason for going. Plus, I've always wanted to travel. I never could have afforded it. My parents had never flown. I really wanted to kind of explore the world. I've always had a lot of curiosity. And people had written things about me that was very adventurous, in which I was. So, anyway, a month before I was to leave to go to Vietnam, he was killed. He was shot down in an airplane.
How did you find out about that?
Through the grapevine. You know, I had a lot of contacts and spent a lot of time with military going to all these different places in the evening. And one of his friends said, oh, it was posted at Camp Pendleton, I guess, and someone had picked it up from there. So I heard about it almost immediately through the grapevine. I think one of his friends called me and told me. Boy, that's not clear in my mind anymore.
Yeah. What kind of effect does that have on a young woman, a gentleman she's seeing, somewhat seriously, I guess, to find out they've been killed in this war?
Pretty awful. Still painful.
Yeah.
And as I thought about it, should I not go or what should I do? I wanted to travel, and it was a free traveling experience. And I don't know what they paying for it, I go over it. My first thought about special status was I thought, well, hey, I can go to France or Germany or someplace really cool. But those were all 3-year commitments. And there were no openings anywhere except for Vietnam. So I didn't manage to go to Vietnam or nothing. But Vietnam was only a 1-year commitment, and I thought, gee, I can do anything for a year. No big deal, so I'll go to Vietnam. And then after Pete was killed, I thought, well, you know, I still would like to go to traveling experiments and so forth. And so I decided I would go. And I even, at one point, did get out to where his camp was, and with a very small squadron, about 13 men that were doing what we were doing. And I took a celebrity out there so that I could go. And one of his best friends gave me a tour of his camp and told me what they were doing. And he really kind of glossed over everything and told me how they were working with the orphans in the area and all the good things they were doing for the people. And never mentioned peace. And tried to make me believe at least you were having chocolate, that you were having a wonderful time, and so forth. And I came away from that kind of feeling strange about it, and that they were just sort of blanking, but then figured they probably had to in order to survive the situation there.
Yeah.
There is a book out now about the flying, I guess it was a time of flying tigers or something or other, and I found out more about what really happened in that book than the other place. Turns out that one of my other friends was Navy, and he still lives in San Diego, and who is a lawyer now, and had this man that wrote the book as a client, and then he never paid for the time. So I guess the guy that wrote the book was still suffering a lot of stuff from what happened over there.
I'll be darned.
And there was quite a whole chapter on what happened to Pete. They were flying two-person airplane. And he picked up a shot that flew in the side window, which was not shot-proof, and stood in the head. And they were in a dive at the time, diving down to shoot some people on the ground. And his co-pilot, that I knew quite well, was able to get the plane home, just barely. But he almost crashed as well, because he was so low at the time that the shot came through. So they almost lost him, and they said in the book that he spent a day just walking around by himself.
Very.
I was not particularly fond of him because he was dating someone in San Diego, and it was his girlfriend's roommate that had paired off with Pete, which was very convenient for the two of them.
I'm sure it would have been,
roommate. And I would see her at go to Friday nights and so forth, and she was really working hard to keep that relationship going. She did go back east, and she did go to the funeral, and I thought, well, I won't go to the funeral because there is nothing really solid between us. And Betty could not make any solid future because he didn't really have one. He'd been in combat flying before, and he knew what it's all about, and it was too risky to have any. But I received several letters for him, and I was still. Actually, some of these are published in the thing that I wrote for a writing class.
Hmm. Oh, yeah, of course. While we have you here back at San Diego, obviously this is a very difficult time, but you also mentioned that you're also preparing to go to Vietnam with the Special Services. Now, at this point, I want to ask you, how much did you know about the Special Services, what they were doing, what your role would be?
I was told it was administrative, and I was in finding places for people to go and setting up their appointment dates and so forth. I don't think I knew a whole lot about it, really.
Yeah. What about, please go ahead.
I knew it would be traveling. I could go over for a year, and whatever they needed done, I had to do. What else did I know? Probably not very much, because I remember I was arriving in the country, and I was met by the fellow who was, I would report to directly. And I was also overwhelmed by the smell of things, and huge piles of garbage and refugees all over the city. It was a real adventure.
Yeah. No,
I think I looked at it more from that point of view.
Right.
And I would be working with adults for the first time in my life.
Mm-hmm.
About 26 years old, I guess, at this point. And I really yearned to have a job where I'd be working to do something that was constructive in the adult world, and rather than trying to get kids to survive and help them through all their problems. And the schools never had enough money to do anything, and the work was just really hard.
Yeah.
And I would take all these things home with me at night time. It really feels for these little kids, and yet, you only spend a few hours with them every day. If they're coming from poor parenting or whatever, you really can't fix that.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is going to be a very, very different thing, sort of thing for you. Was there any sort of training, specialized training or courses or anything for the Special Services prior to deployment?
Nothing.
So you've been accepted. You know that you're going to go to Vietnam, and then nothing. How do you prepare? How do you prepare yourself? What goes on in your preparation to take this very, very big step?
They do send you what you have to get there. And a whole bunch of, in my case, $264 worth of purchases to make for you, how you're going to look when you get there. And they included a uniform that was probably styled in the 1940s, and this is 1969 now, and many skirts are at their peak. I mean, it's really short, and we're all wearing them. And we get this uniform requirement, and you must wear the uniform 3 inches below the knees, and first goes over the left shoulder, and the hat's cocked a certain way, and we have white gloves, and we have into the half heels, and have to be navy blue. And it went on and on and on. And you look at this and say, I had to have a coat, which turned out to be a coat with a liner. It was a great coat, actually, but it wasn't really fit for the tropics.
Right.
But it did work well when I traveled through Europe in the wintertime.
So Special Services clearly had an ideal of what they wanted everyone to look like. Pretty conservative dress for this kind of environment.
Yes, and it was established probably in the 1940s because that was the style of the garment that fit to the waist and flared like a little skirt,
mm-hmm.
and a straight skirt. And, well, it was totally impractical for what I was going to be doing. But anyway, to get over there, you put the $264 and all this stuff together. And took it with you when you went. And I had to get two uniforms, the two sets of those things. And I was wearing one of them on the airplane. I was the only civilian woman on the airplane leaving from The airport near here.
Travis, probably.
What was it?
Was it Travis?
Travis, yes.
Yeah.
This is it from Travis. And getting to Travis was a whole other affair with the family.
Well, tell me about that. I'm curious to what your family and friends thought about you going to Vietnam.
Well, of course, my parents did not want me, their only child, to go to Vietnam. Why in the world would I want to do that? And I knew they couldn't stop me, so anyway, I went. By the time that came along, my mother and father had finally separated, and my mother had remarried. And a man she, out of the frying pan and the fire, the man she married was also an alcoholic, but he was a pleasant one.
Hmm.
He was just drinking. Get smarter and smarter and smarter. He knew everything. He had to have that last word on everything, and he finally fell asleep. So that was, he was very social. So he got all of you involved in the Elk Club, Elk Edge, I called it, England Club. And she got to do her social things, and it was good for her.
Yeah.
It was really good for her. But when it came time for me to go to Vietnam, he was military, civilian. And she had a cousin in the area here, so I stayed with them for a night or two. And we went from there and up near Travis, so we had another cousin up there that we stayed with. And they had a young man about my age that was supposed to, I guess, take me to Travis. I'd be at Travis when it was time to go. Well, we had spent some time the evening before, and we didn't hit it off too well. So he disappeared that day, and he was not around to take me anywhere.
Hmm.
And it was unclear to me who was supposed to drive me to Travis. Well, it turned out that my stepfather had to do it. Of course, by this time, he was pretty drunk because he'd been drinking all day. So it was a real joyride, and I really thought that I'd probably be in a traffic accident and get killed before I ever got to Vietnam. But he did get me there just in the nick of time. I barely made it onto the airplane. I was the only civilian woman that was on the airplane.
What was that plane ride like over there?
The first half was great. I had a young man sitting there that was very interesting to talk with. And then they stopped someplace, they got off. Oh, I guess in the Philippines. Yeah, they stopped over in the Philippines. Everybody got off for a break. But I got back on, he didn't sit back down. And later he said that, well, he didn't want to take all of my time and he'd give somebody else a chance. Well, the man that sat down would not stop talking. They brought him food. He wouldn't even eat the food because he had to talk. And he's like, I'm going to sleep now. And I went to sleep. I pretended to. So that was not so much fun. And during the Philippines, I'd gone to the restroom. And I did open the glasses on my face, fell into the toilet.
Oh, no.
And I looked at that, and I go in after my glasses, or do I just flush them down the toilet?
What did you decide?
I went in after them. So anyway, your program was interesting. I had lots of attention, but most of the guys were realizing my situation and were kind about it.
So where do you come into country?
I came into Saigon from the airport. Mm-hmm. And I was picked up by Brad Arrington, who was the man I'd be working under. And he was a total delight. But again, I had no training. I just arrived with my uniform, and they took me to a hotel there where I would be billeted.
Tell me about your first experiences in Saigon. This is a very different scene, very different environment from what you grew up with in California. What are, as a 26-year-old, what are your thoughts and memories of what went on, was going on in Saigon when you were there?
Well, I was picked up from the airport and it was still too tense. The smell. Well, actually, the smell starts before you even hit the ground. And I don't know that it happened the first time this happened, all the other trips after this. Within probably 30 minutes of hitting ground, my stomach would start flip-flopping.
Mm.
And I had dysentery the entire year I was there.
Really?
Mm-hmm. Probably, I guess, a mild stage of it. But a lot of that. Anyway, the first time I was picked up, I just remember how hot it was, hot and moist, and water. I got there during August, and I think that's monsoon season. And every day from like 2 to 4 it rained. So the streets are always wet, and there was huge, huge piles of garbage that might have been 20 feet high, 20, 30 feet high. And of course, the stench was overcoming. But the plant growth was fascinating. I saw philodendrons that had leaves that were probably 12, 18 inches from stem to tip.
Mm-hmm.
These are these little house plants that we grow at home that, you know, they're little tiny leaves the size of a couple inches long. And they were growing up huge buildings. They would be up maybe climbing up the buildings in 5, 6, 7 floors, and these huge, huge leaves. And I was fascinated by the vegetation and the tropical plant life and so forth. It was just truly beautiful. The fences were green with mold. Most of the fences were concrete or plaster. And I thought, gosh, don't they ever paint these things? Well, after I was there a while, I realized why they did. And of course, refugees were everywhere. A lot of them were living in, my mind is going, things you tie between two trees.
Oh, like sleeping in hammocks or something like that?
Hammocks. That's
yeah.
What I'm trying to think. Yeah, a lot of hammocks tied between two trees or a post of some sort in a tree. People are just living there, living on the street. Of course, it's a warm climate, and when it rains, it's kind of a relief from the local people. The rain is cooler than the air.
Mm-hmm.
And the little kids go out in the street because the streets fill up, and we have 18 inches of water running down the street, and they're out there playing in it. And that goes on every day, I would say. Let's see, what else happens? Of course, you get moved into your hotel room and so forth, and there's where you get the food.
Well, describe the hotel for me. What were your quarters like?
I remember the hotel room.
Mm-hmm.
It was a civilian hotel that the military had taken over. And I think the only people billeted at that time in that hotel were probably people like myself, people coming and going. And the head of our department was also living on a different floor than I was, but he had a larger room than my room, and they all had air conditioning, which was nice. That was a big patron in those days. Then, of course, I got to go into the office, and that's where I got my education, I guess. And here's what you do. Here's today's assignment. Here's three people to assign throughout the area and so forth. I don't know. I didn't care. This is what I needed to do. Sometimes I was sent to the USO, where they might be interviewing different groups from the Philippines or from Australia, and they had to rate them, and how we rated them, how the judges rated them, determined their salaries when they were out in the field, and Philippines and so forth out in the field could hire these groups to come in and entertain them. And quite a bit of that. And most of it was pretty boring.
Well, I think now might be a good point for you, if you can. Tell me what the role, the mission of Special Services was in Vietnam, and what you specifically would be responsible for.
The role was to entertain the troops to give them some relief on their off time. My friend Ann Chelsea did library. She took books to different groups. Kept it literary, so they had some entertainment. But I did is take celebrities into various groups, sometimes shows, depending on who it was and what it was. They had a big show that required had celebrities and maybe a bunch of people. Typically, they had to have relatives someplace with air conditioning. They had to have air conditioning behind the stage. They had to have a lot of security, so those could only go a few places, like Long Bend, Chongqing had a theater, Penang, of course, had a theater. They could only be taken to those kind of places. While I was there, the fellow I was working for, eventually gave his slot to me. He was a DS-11, and so, you can do what I'm doing here, because I want to start a military command for yourself. And that became a very popular program. He was taking people, men out of the field and bringing them in on great duty, rehearsing them as a group, and then sending them out to the troops again to entertain the troops. And because they were military, they could go out in jeeps, they could go out and they could send them because they didn't have to have them flown in airplanes and so forth. They didn't have to have a security protection that celebrities required.
Sure.
And then sometimes they just had handshake groups, they called handshake groups. Ron Ely is one of the early Tarzans, was one of those. He was my favorite one of all the ones that ever came. And I would escort them, put them on helicopters, fly them to either 3 or 4 different places during the day. And they would just walk around and talk to the troops. And those were very popular, especially with Tarzan. He was much loved by the troops. So I took him to Amin, which was where they did a lot of airplane and whatnot repairing. So they had a very sophisticated group of engineers, I guess you'd call them. And when I got him, not Ron Ely, off the helicopter, they came running onto the tarmac. Tarzan! Tarzan! And during their spare time, they did a lot of weightlifting, so they were all bodybuilders. So they had a lot of bodybuilding conversations. And the Tarzan, Ron Ely, was probably in his, maybe late 30s or so, I don't know. And he told stories about when he was Tarzan. He quit that job because he'd gotten hurt so many times. But I distinctly remember the commercials of Tarzan diving off this cliff into water, and he was doing a swan dive, and it was a really high dive. And he talked about that, or maybe it came up in the conversations, the questions and answers that occurred during our tours. And he said, yeah, it knocked me out when I hit the water. And then when I was climbing back up the ladder to go to the top, how far did I go anyway? How high was this place? It turned out 125 feet.
Holy smokes.
Yeah. I jumped off a rope one time into a swimming pool and dive. And when I hit the water, the force of the water, really, my arms out in front of me didn't really shelter me very much. I can't imagine like hitting the water at 125 feet. I guess, well, it knocked you out, so I guess you know. But that's like hitting concrete, probably.
Yeah, I bet it is, yeah.
But he was just a real outgoing guy. It was just such a humor. One of the questions, we had a small group on the Vietnam border, Cambodia border, that all sat down under a little shade roof. And one of the questions was, one of the men, I understand when there's a tall man or a short, when the love interests are two different types that are not that compatible, that sometimes they put people on boxes. Is that really true? And he said, well, Kay, come up here. And I took these people out. I used to kind of stay in the background, so I didn't feel the show. Those men were not accustomed to seeing a lot of American women, so it was pretty easy to feel the show. But I was always pretty careful about that. And he said, Kay, come on up here. And he got this little box and made me stand on it. And but that's just the kind of guy he was. I mean, he was really very down to earth, very pragmatic about what he talked about, and the guys just loved him. I had James Franciscus out there at one point, I had a chance to remember this guy's name. He played Banachek on television with him, the blind guy with the dog.
Oh, yes. I know who you're talking about.
Papard. Something Papard. Anyway, I had him out. And I guess he was going to divorce, and he heard I was going to be after. I don't want any women going up with me. I'm so used to be after. I knew he was a little bit, and he didn't really want me to be escorting him.
George Papard, right?
George Papard. And it turned out he was kind of an intellectual type. I took him to Louis Vagin one day, which is a volcanic-like mountain in the middle of flat Vietnam, southern Vietnam, and they used it for a fire support base, and there probably was a couple, I don't know, maybe 100, 200 men up there, although it's probably a smaller group. Anyway, he went one direction, so I went a different direction. Usually on situations like that, I would have my own audience, and I didn't want to be anywhere near where he was because I knew he didn't really want me to be, and we flown out by helicopter. On the way back in from that, there was a little gully that went down. Of course, he's in the monsoons, and it was very slick, and it's that red mud that sticks to your shoes and goes up until you're walking in silt.
Mm-hmm.
And he slipped, fell on his behind, and I made some outrageous comment. I can't remember what it was. And he turned around and just glared at me. Oh, he got to the helicopter before I did. Of course, I was busy talking to other people. But when I got there, his hand came out, reached out, helped me on the first step, which is about 4 feet off the ground. And when I grabbed the hand, it suddenly released me. I looked up, and it was George. And he's feeling from ear to ear, like, oh, I could have let you fall in the mud. I'm so grateful he didn't. But then after that, by the time he got back, we were good friends, and he told me if I ever got into Hollywood, he'd please look him up, he would love. But I got the feeling, and I think later he became known as gay. I got the feeling during that that what a lot of these celebrities go through is women like to put notches on their bedposts.
Mm-hmm.
And they said, oh, no, another one of these. And I didn't go over there to date men. And I had to tell a lot of men that I'm not here to date men. I'm here to entertain the troops, to get some personal experience. I'm here because I'm paid reasonably well, more than I would make as a teacher, and something to do. It has nothing to do with my date life or putting notches on my bed.
Yeah. Well, that's really a difficult position to be in, though. Yeah. That's a difficult position to be in. You are, in the parlance of the times, you're a round-eye woman who is there spending her entire tour around troops who don't see very many American women. And biology being what it is, did you face any difficulties in this way?
Constantly, yeah.
Yeah?
Constantly.
Do you care to talk about that?
Sure. The enlisted men were never a problem. I haven't told you about the Charlie Brown thing. I did tell you that Brad Arrington wanted to be the command military touring shows. He was a drama person. And one of the military touring shows was a good man, Charlie Brown. They couldn't find any women to do the part, so they recruited me. And I traveled all over Vietnam with 9 enlisted men and doing 19 performances of You're a Good Man, Charlie Brown. So I saw a good deal of a lot of different camps and areas and so forth. And the guys I traveled with were great. They were like brothers, all of them were. And if I went into a camp, it was, okay, who gets the girl? Well, none of us get the girl. Oh, come on, you can tell me. And every single place we went, it was like that. And I guess the big deal, or the high point of this, was we went to Happy Valley, which was near Chain Inn, or near the Trang, I guess. And Happy Valley, it was a transportation group, and they were taking convoys out to the troops on a daily basis or whatever. And there were about maybe 250 men there, I don't know. And 10 officers. And let's see, we landed, well, we came from Pleiku that day, and the weather was kind of bad, it was rainy and stormy. We waited for hours for our helicopter to deliver us to Happy Valley, and the helicopter never came. I guess was busy doing other stuff. And they finally put us on a bus and sent us across land, unsecured land. And the guys all had guns, of course, and I didn't. And I thought, you know, I came over here in my uniform. No one's ever shown me how to shoot one of these guns. And my father had taught me to shoot. I was fairly accurate and decent at it. So there's no reason why I couldn't have learned to shoot a gun. If our bus was overtaken, it would have been nice to be able to defend myself. And all the guys assured me they would make sure I was safe. But outside of that, I was always told that when you get attacked and then protect themselves, they'll forget all about you.
Hmm.
So don't depend on them for anything. So who knows whether what's true on that case.
Right.
On the season. But I had no training at all in any kind of military human. So anyway, we got into Happy Valley, and I was immediately taken off the bus and led to a trailer where the two service club girls were, or women were. And that was air conditioned. and then the men were taken off someplace else. And I always met with them to make sure that everything was working okay for them. So I saw them at dinner time, and on the troops, the enlisted men were on one side, the officers on the other, and I saw all the guys in the enlisted side. So I went through the twins file and said, well, how are things going? How would you be? And so forth. And typically they would be blankets or pillows or whatever, or someplace to secure their costumes. One place, all the costumes were stolen because they wouldn't secure them for us. So anyway, I was stuck with them. Well, finally someone came in and pulled me out of there and told me I was not supposed to be there because I was an officer equivalent.
Hmm.
So I was taken over to eat with the military, the officers, and there were 10 of them, I believe. And we sat down at a beautiful table with a tablecloth, gorgeous china, beautiful silverware, candles. The minister gave a grace, and they had a very sophisticated meal. And afterwards, I was invited to stay and drink with them. And I said, well, no, I have to get ready for this performance. And let's see, somewhere, a lieutenant was put in charge of the guys. He said, well, you know, we're going to have, I said, you can get together after the performance and kind of unwind. And can that be provided for us? Well, yeah, and we have some soft drinks for the men. I said, look, these men do not want soft drinks. They're fighting the war over here. And they would really like some beer. Can you get that? Well, I'll try really hard. So, anyway, after the performance, we were led to a closet hut, and we had our beer and kind of unwound. And at one point during that time, one of the two service club ladies came in, and she said, I just wanted to make sure. I said, well, why don't you stay and you'll have some beer with us? Oh, no, oh, no. But she left. Well, I guess I was probably there until 10:45 or so when I was walked back to the trailer. And as soon as I got into the trailer, one of the gals went and phoned somebody, and then she said, well, the colonel would like to speak with you. And I looked at my watch. It was 11 o'clock at night. The colonel wanted to speak to me. What's this all about? So anyway, the three of us were escorted over to the colonel's office, and he was sitting there with his palm trees and his wooden paneling and his pictures of Dixon. And he sat at one end, and they sat across one side. I thought, well, there's two of them over there. I'll sit over here. And he proceeded to lecture me on fraternizing with the enlisted men for about 45 minutes. And I was just boiling. I was smoking.
That's your job, right?
It's unsecured territory with these nine men on a bus to get off the bus and be told I'm fraternizing with the enlisted men. I mean, really. And these guys cared more about me than he did, obviously. So I was just smoking. And he finally said, well, do you have any questions or is there anything you want to say? Are we finished? Can I go back and get some rest now? And then he just turned red in the face. That was not what he wanted to hear. And anyway, we went back to the trailer, and I was just really upset about this. We didn't sleep very much that night. And the next morning, we had breakfast, and we were off to the next wherever we were going. And I happened to say to them, how was your night? And I probably shouldn't have said anything to them, at least until we were out of there. But I told them what had happened, and they were livid. And a couple of them went into the restroom, and they were talking about it in the restroom, I guess, in the stalls, and an officer came in and overheard them, went running back to the whatever he was, the main guy, the colonel, and told him, and he started calling Saigon, telling the Saigon Special Services how horrible I had been, and so forth. So anyway, that was kind of the worst of it. And I later found out more and more information. The service club girls, one of them belonged to the colonel. The other one, I'm not sure whose property she was or how she was all, you know, I had no idea what her situation was. But then I began to realize that they really had the thumb on her. She had been in, I think, someplace, Korea maybe, or someplace else. She'd been in special services, and she had a bad report. So she was being given a second chance in Vietnam, and if this went badly, her career was over.
Hmm.
So they really had a lot of pressure on her. She really probably couldn't say a whole lot. And I reported this to a special service woman in charge, and she was in Longdon. And I said, I really think Debbie might have a problem there. I know she's working under duress because she can't do another quarter to do. And I'm told by the rumor mill that she's the criminal lady. And anyway, she was pulled out of there. Probably because of what I had said. Went into an airport waiting room at one point. She didn't even speak to me.
I'll be darned.
I feel like that was doing. When I got back to Saigon, the first thing was meeting with the riot act, and I explained what was going on there. They all had, you know, I was supposed to spend the night with somebody there, who knows who. But it's just more of military power over the women who were there, which I really resented. And I guess this was long after I started, had done my civilian thing on the uniform.
Right, which we want to get to.
I didn't
say
how I started. I'd probably been in country for a month or two when a fellow came in from Canso. And he's sitting there across and telling me all these things. And I finally looked at him and I said, how come they're not wearing a uniform? But I had realized that none of the women are wearing uniforms. And I have to wear this stupid uniform. And the first time I jumped off the helicopter, all the guys got off first. And I thought, oh, they're going to help me off? What is this? And no, they were going to gawk at me if I got off, because the only way I could possibly get off that helicopter was to shoot a beaver shot. And they were all waiting for it. So I thought, okay, this is the last time I wear this straight shirt into the mud in the monsoon. I wear high heels where I'm slipping down slippery red mud monsoon puddles. And of course, you wouldn't consider white gloves.
Right.
Who needs a hat? And who needs this purse? So it was just completely impractical to wear out of the field.
Yeah. Well, let me stop you there, Kay, because I want to spend a lot more time on this. We probably don't have enough time today. So let's stop our session for today. Kelly Kreger continuing an oral history interview with Kay Johnson. Today is 3 December 2018. I am in Lubbock, Texas, and Ms. Johnson is joining me by telephone again from Redwood Shores, California. Okay, Kay, we left off last time. You mentioned something about the uniforms that you were required to wear, and I know that this is something that became a very serious issue for you and your efforts to deal with this issue. And as you so lovingly called it, Project Ugly. Tell me about this. Where does Project Ugly originate, and what brought this about? And take me through the narrative of what this was all about, please.
Oh, when I first decided I would put on all the papers to apply for this position, I think I filled out papers for a good 8 months. It was a lot of paper filling out. And before I could actually get on the airplane to go, I had to have a uniform. And looking through my paperwork today to review my memory, I actually had to buy 4 of them, I can't believe. I don't recall more than 2, but maybe I threw a couple away. This was all about AR-670-10, the uniform for civilian female employees. Men were not allowed, and that's the way it says in the regulations, not allowed to wear the uniform. And I found out about this when I was being one of our special services officers from 4 Corps was in our office one day in Saigon, and I asked him where his uniform was, and he got fell off his chair laughing. He would not be caught dead in a uniform, was his response. So I began looking into it more. And I'm reading through some of my notes here.
Okay.
Let's see. Anyway, I started the process. First, I just asked politely if I could be excused from wearing my uniform. They were to be worn, they were straight skirts to be worn below the knees. And of course, this is 1969, when we were all wearing mini skirts that were about as short as you could possibly bear. And the first thing I did before I went over, actually, was I hemmed it above the knees, just slightly above my knees, which I thought was better than below the knees, but intolerable. Although not as short as you were accustomed to wearing things. So I noticed pretty much everybody over there had done the same thing. Nobody was wearing them below the knees. The first time I took his celebrity out with a helicopter, which was our main mode of transportation, when I got off the helicopter, all of the men who were on the helicopter jumped off first, and I thought maybe they were going to help me off, but no, they were waiting for the fever shot that I was going to make if I exited the helicopter. And that was the last time I ever wore this uniform out in the field. It was totally impractical, and I had tailor-made some camouflage pants and a top that matched that I, and pink tennis shoes that I wore instead of my high heels that were required to get into the country. So anyway, that's how it kind of started. It was impractical. The men were not wearing it. I was told that the four women who were hired that summer were the first four to be sent into combat or into a combat area. I don't know that that's true. I've heard from others that that was not true, but maybe it was the first four special services women sent into the combat area. I don't know. Anyhow, it was an impractical outfit to have to wear in the field, and it cost me over $265 to get all this stuff together and carted over to Vietnam. But that would be an expense that men would not have to bear. We were given uniforms, $125 each year, and I think I received the first year, and if I continued on this career position, I would receive $125 a year to compensate for new uniforms. But since the first set cost me a lot more than that, hardly really replaced the expense. Looks like I arrived in country in August of 1969, and some of my earliest writings are from December 69. Just requesting, and I went to the Major General in the USA, the Adjutant General, to ask permission not to wear it, and I was told that I was to wear it as long as it was part of the regulation. And another letter in here to Major Avery through Mr. Myers, who was my contact. That was April 1970, and more letters. Here's April 27th, a letter from John C. Avery to me in reply to my letter, paragraph 4.1, chapter 4, section 1, AR 670-10, requires wearing of uniforms by social services female personnel until such time as this regulation is rescinded or modified. You are required to wear the prescribed uniform. A couple more paragraphs there, but that was basically it. Then I guess I filed a grievance, a civilian grievance about this. So it went up to the chain of command. And this is going on until I left. And my 1 year commitment was over in August. I did extend a few days because I was busy conducting a choir and had some performances to do. And then I traveled for 3 months before I got home. And a couple of months after I got home, I did receive a letter from the military saying that my case had been dropped since I was no longer involved. But then about, within the next year, I heard that women going over were not wearing uniforms any longer. So apparently it did do some good, but of course I was not given credit for it.
Were there other women who were having issues with this?
Oh, all of us were.
Yeah?
Well, there were four women who went over. Nan Noll was another one. She had a PhD in singing from Indiana. She was an opera singer. We had a woman in class. Can't think of her name at the moment. And another one that was in drama. So those are the four of us. And Nan was sent to Miss Frank, who was the special services director there. The director of two corps, and he had her fixing his coffee and delivering his lunch. And after a few weeks of that, she moved out to the beach and lived with some fellow out there for a while, and then she came to Saigon and stalked into Mr. Myers' room and said, "Either you find me a real job, and when you do, give me a call. Meanwhile, I'll be available here if I need 16 and she disappeared into Saigon. And she began doing recitals and also put on the first opera ever done in Saigon, which was Hansel and Gretel, using Vietnamese children. They never sent her home for not showing up for work, which I was kind of surprised. She took a tour to, I think it was India, and did a whole opera thing tour there, came back to Saigon. Well, she was living happily ever after in Saigon until her commitment was done, and she never did get, they never did assign her again to anything. She was just free of being paid.
Yeah.
So that was her situation. Jan Brantley stayed in Saigon. She was helping Brad Erickson with the Pan Military Touring Shows. She mostly did office work, she did with her uniform mostly. So it didn't bother her as much as it did me. She was not out in the field doing escort. She did travel with a couple of touring shows. And of course, I traveled with your good man, Charlie Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't take any uniforms with me on that trip.
So I assume you went to your higher. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Just to answer some of your questions.
Yeah. I assume that you took this, your concerns, you know, these uniforms are just impractical, and certainly the way you're looking at it, certainly not fair that men are not wearing them, having to wear uniforms, but you are, and they're unwieldy and uncomfortable, all these sort of things. So do you take this to your higher up, to the next person in the chain of command? Does it go that way, or do you go straight to the adjutant general? How did that work?
I took it to the person in charge first. I reported to Brad Arrington, and have a handwritten note about that and his reply. Just basically, he didn't want me to ruffle anybody's. He just kind of told me to beg off and tolerate it rather than stir up any stew. And so then I took it to the person he reported to, who was in our office, got the same thing. And then made my civilian grievance with the civilian department, and a fellow named Mr. Waltmade was involved in that, and he told me it was the first civilian grievance in Vietnam. And so he kind of handled it from there on, but there are letters flying around everywhere, and you know, it was basically the same answer, these are the rules, follow them.
Yeah. Did you get any pushback from someone saying, hey, you know, this is going to affect your career, shut up and play ball, there's going to be trouble, anything like that?
Oh, yes. Finally, Mr. Myers, towards the end of the year, called me in. Oh, I guess by this time I was talking to the fellow in charge. Forgotten his name. Anyway, he was stationed at Long Bend, and he was the person that Mr. Myers reported to, and it had gotten to him. And I had written to him asking him to waive this requirement, and he didn't answer my letter. And civilians had a 10-day response. He was supposed to be responded to within 10 days, and I think 3 weeks went by, and I hadn't heard from him. So I went to Mr. Meyer's office and said, I'd like to be on the mail run to Long Bend because I need to talk to this general, whoever he was. And, oh, no, don't go. I'll be here tomorrow. I'll go for you, and I'll talk with you about it. I said, well, okay. So I can listen. I came into the office the next day, and where's Mr. Myers? I thought he was going on the mail run. Oh, his wife had a problem, and he flew off to Bangkok. Oh, well, that's nice. He didn't tell me. Of course, there was no way to tell me.
Right.
Communication channels were pretty poor. So I got on the mail truck, and I went to and spoke to this fellow. And he said, why are you here? Well, I'm here because I wrote to you about uniforms. Did anyone answer your letter? No, sir. No one answered my letter. And it was directed to you. And there's more of this story because Long Bend Post had been trying to move me out of Saigon to Long Bend, or who knows why, because my job was working with celebrities who were billeted in Saigon, picking them up at the airport, getting them into their billeting, making sure they were comfortable and taken care of. Picking them up, putting them on the helicopters, taking them where they needed to go, etc. So I don't know how I could have done that in Long Bend, which took an hour to get to from Saigon, even though it's maybe 25, 30 miles. The traffic was really bad. So I could not have functioned in that position out of Long Bend. Mm-hmm. And yes, they were definitely trying to get me to Long Bend so I could live in the billet there. And of course, I knew how bad it was in Long Bend because when we did the Charlie Brown show, I spent a couple of weeks in Long Bend, and the women, where the women were billeted. And it was a two-story wooden building, and didn't have windows, it just had screen wire. No curtains, of course. And the community showers were down in the middle of the bottom level. At 5 o'clock every Friday, a bus would come and park outside the women's building there. And all of the guys would come off, and they would raid the showers, they would raid the entire building. Because I was an officer equivalent, I got a fan and sheets and blankets, and well, sheets and laying a pillow, which not everybody got. But that's how bad it was there.
You said these guys would come in and raid the place. What do you mean by that?
Well, they would actually go into the showers and hear the women screaming, and they'd be running out with a towel around themselves.
Wow.
And the men thought this was really funny. And it happened. I mean, the bus brought them there, and it happened every Friday. it was the usual thing.
Who were these folks? Were they new in country? Were they headed to R&R somewhere? Who were these guys?
Well, the Long Bend Post had 40,000 men on it at that time. I think the largest post, certainly in I Corps, probably anywhere. And probably mostly officers, I would guess. I don't know. Because women were not, well, okay, let's get back to the military status. Officers pretty much felt they owned any American woman who was there. Because if you were officer equivalent, which I was not allowed to fraternizing with the enlisted men. And I'm sure that was probably true of all women, whether they were officer equivalent or not. American women were not supposed to fraternize, which means talk to or be friendly, unless you're in a service club or someplace and giving them a ping pong paddle. You were not supposed to have any friendships with them. And the officers were not accustomed to hearing no, because no one ever told them no, nor were they accustomed to having questions asked, because they were military people, and they were pretty arrogant. And well, since I was a civilian, I did not have to report to anyone military, which was very frustrating to them because they really didn't have any power over me. And they could take my vehicles away, which they did. The Long Bend Post vehicles away from the Special Service office there because I refused to live there, be billeted there. They could do those kinds of things, but they really couldn't get me fired, for example, because I refused to cooperate with going out to dinner on Friday evening or whatever. Even within our office, I had problems. I couldn't get transportation because the sergeant wouldn't see that I had any transportation unless I would go out with him, which I refused to do. So I didn't have transportation, which meant when they moved the office from the center of Saigon to the outer edges where there were no restaurants or anything, I couldn't get any lunch unless I packed it and took it, or took a taxi or a piccolo or something. Where I could eat. So toward the end of my tour, I actually didn't even put full days in when I had office days because I would get hungry, and by 2 o'clock I would just go home and then stay home rather than try to get back because it was such a hassle. And I was also given an office without air conditioning at that point. In Saigon, when we were in the center, we had an air-conditioned building. We were all together. I think I'm probably getting off the point here.
No, that's okay. I mean, you're talking about getting some blowback from this effort that you're making, it sounds like.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there was no cooperation. The last thing anyone in the military wanted to hear was advice from a woman. That's not, they were playing their war games. And I did develop kind of an attitude, I suppose. Um,
Did the other women in special services support you, either openly or behind the scenes?
Oh, they all had their problems, I think. Nan was pretty liberal. She had an affair with Colonel Myrick, a black man who was quite an exceptional man, really. And she also had, she kind of went both ways. She had women friends, too. The other woman up in Cameron Bay, she was dating a black man. I think he was an officer, but that's okay. You know, as long as they're officers, it's okay. And she also smoked cigars. So, you know, we had different kinds of women over there. And I'm sure they all received problems. And, of course, there were women who would come into Saigon and they would put themselves out for hire. And they would have lines lined up. And they were getting $50 a throw in those days.
And this was widely known?
Oh, yeah.
And although I assume strictly forbidden still, in addition to being illegal, still going on.
Oh, yeah. Well, it was just everything was going crazy there. You were supposed to get all of your currency at the bank, and the exchange rate was pathetic, so no one did it. We all exchanged our currency somewhere in the black market. And I didn't smoke, but I still had cigarette rations, so what did I do with them? Well, I had fellows who would come to me and say, "Can I sell your cigarette rations for you?" Sure, why not? So those got sold on the black market as well. There was wheeling and dealing going on at all levels. We had trouble getting our trucks because they come over on the ships and they would disappear as soon as they hit the dock. Thought to be Vietnamese taking them, who knows. I was aware that there were shipments of machine guns that an American civilian, was selling or doing something with them. I didn't want to know too much about it for fear that maybe I would get involved and my life might be threatened. But there was just wheeling and dealing going on all the time. When there were big parties, they would have steak and lobster. Well, that was done through wheeling and dealing, trading off things. You know, like if I want transportation to lunch, I would have to go out with this guy. I mean, it's just that kind of stuff. It was just the way it was because they didn't really have currency that we could exchange easily. There was a black market, and I was getting American dollars in, and people would go to Hong Kong, bring back American dollars, which were 20 times more valuable than anything else. The NPC we dealt with was pretty stupid, and you know, an effort to make people do things a certain way, but no real incentive to do it, and rarely did you ever get caught for it. And of course, as a civilian, it would be even more rare. One of the guys working for me got picked up for selling the cigarette rations. I felt really badly about that. I think he was selling some of mine as well. And he was a 19-year-old. I had three men working for me. One was Tom Salisbury, who was very talented, most talented musician I've ever worked with. After Vietnam, he traveled for 3 years with the Pointer Sisters and had quite a musical career. Actually opened a concert for Elton John one time. And then another, Burton Hamm, he did a lot of the administrative work for me. And we hired David, this young guy, because he was a great drummer. And Tom was putting on all kinds of various shows and keeps the musicians at hand. So I had these three guys, very talented young men, working for me. All enlisted, all draftees.
You have these kinds of things going on. The first question that comes to my mind is, where was the leadership when all this was going on?
Oh, they were busy. They were doing it too. Everybody was doing it.
Yeah.
Everybody did. There was an attitude that the government doesn't, well, among the enlisted and among people really involved in the gritty work, there's an attitude that the government really doesn't care anything about it. It's a political war. And it was obvious once I got there. The reasons I went, I wanted to find out, we all went to stop the spread of communism, in theory. And of course, I wanted to learn about how my country worked and all the good things it did. And also, women's traditional roles were not choices I wanted to make.
Yeah.
And also, I spent the 2 years before going over in San Diego. So I was seeing a lot of the men because all the young women there spent their Friday nights at MCRD, the officers' club, meeting all these men who are either coming or going, most of them going to Vietnam. So it was my peer group. Those are the men my age, and they are all running off to Vietnam, so why shouldn't I go to Vietnam? All my friends were there. Travel and adventure. But once you get there, you realize that it's a political war. It was rumored that Pat Nixon owned the water plant in Saigon. I heard that from a lot of different sources. I was never able to prove it. But everybody was over there doing and doing, making their fortune. The government didn't care about them. So therefore, you did whatever you could to make life good and to make as much money and to benefit in whatever way you could. That was just kind of the attitude. And people I knew who had been there for 2 and 3 years were by this time experts at wheeling and dealing, and they could come up with anything you wanted. It was a challenge, and it was more fun than war.
Hmm. Well, what did you think about this kind of attitude after you lived within it for a period of time? You kind of see this thing forming. What was your opinion of that?
I didn't think it was healthy. It was a survival technique, and I would not have gone more than 1 year, because I think after a while you start getting into this, and toward the end of my time, I was selling my cigarette rations and doing a few stupid things.
Mm-hmm.
But if I had been there longer, I would have gotten better at it and would have had more contact and would have been, I could have done a lot more.
Yeah.
And people, as they are, not that I'm inclined that way, I'm not, but it's a survival technique when nothing else is working. I mean, the telephones didn't work, communication didn't work, being forced to wear a uniform thing is my better judgment. Trying to do work that we got very little accolades for.
Mm-hmm.
And everything was so disjointed and it was so I guess it was trying to control it. I had a job, but I also had a free rein on a lot of things. I ended up doing posters. There was so much that needed to be done there that you never had a free moment. You could fill your time so easily because there wasn't enough personnel to really do some of the nitty-gritty stuff that needed to be done, like posters and getting advertisement out for the shows we did and so forth. And Tom wanted to compete in the Parade of American Music, and he did 4 concerts for that. And they were all done in Saigon. So he would get these groups of people, we'd get the guys out from the field, put them on TDY, rehearse them, and they put on these programs. And we won a huge award for that. And Tom also did 2 different big concerts for the Vietnamese people. And he must have brought in 3,000, mostly just local Vietnamese. A rock show with videos on the walls, and it was a big happening in Saigon. And some of those things were really worthwhile. Of course, Nan's Hansel and Gretel opera that she did. There's a lot to be done there. But none of it was legally done, according to what we were supposed to be doing.
What about
these concerts, because they were worthwhile. They were being enjoyed, and they were reaping in a lot of goodwill for the Vietnam people.
Yeah. What about some of the things that you saw as positives that was going on with the special services, or in Vietnam in general? I mean, in addition to these concerts that you just mentioned, it kind of makes me think of, okay, we've talked about some of the more negative aspects of what's going on, but what about the positive aspects? Did you see any? If so, what were they?
It was a beautiful country, and there were quite a few French people still there. my eyes were beautiful, as the women wore, and I had several of the maids that I wore. When I went over, I had a choice of living in wherever the government would put me and eating in the cafeterias. Well, that didn't go so well because when I'd go to eat dinner, I would be the only woman in the whole room. And it was hard to eat because I had a lot of interference. So I decided I really would rather take the stipend and live on the economy, which I did.
Hmm.
Well, I had a marvelous landlord. Right. Well, I suppose anyone who's a landowner there is probably well off compared to the other people. And, of course, the city was full of refugees, people who lived on cots and just on the curbs. But there were some beautiful homes there, made probably by the French, in French colonial style. And Victor was my landlord, and his parents lived on the first and second floor, and I rented the third floor from them. And they had two children. They had a daughter and a son. Victor was the son, and he had U.S. citizenship and Vietnamese, of course, and the sister had French citizenship. So Victor had a bank account in L.A., and that's how I paid him in U.S. dollars, by transferring money from my U.S. bank to his U.S. bank once a month. And in that way, he got the full $265 that I was allowed for living on the economy. If I had to pay him in piastres, which is what the government wanted me to do, I probably would have paid him $150. No, I would have paid him less, because it was about 1/6 of the, yeah, it would have been, you know, maybe $50 or something a month instead of $265. Lovely people. Lots of lovely people. I had a little Madame Bouy who did housekeeping for me, and she was totally lovely. Worked hard, always showed up, and gave me a beautiful gift of a Vietnamese hat that she had signed when I left. So there were good people there. Nan was very involved with the French community. They said she did some French concerts, and she had the French people help her with her pronunciation. So she was more in tune with them. They had a sport chief that was very nice. You could even go horseback riding there. The swimming pool looked like it was filled with mud. So that wasn't very, it was black. So, but that was kind of a social club.
Right. Yeah, the Circle Sportif.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
How often would you visit this place? It's a pretty famous place.
I was only there a couple of times. It's hard to get into, so you had to get membership. And getting membership took most of the year. And so by the time I got in, I really didn't have much time to enjoy it. I did go horseback riding one day. The horses are very small, but there was one horse there that was gorgeous. And I'm sure that, you know, the owners of the place or whatever, only the privileged could ride it. But it had been brought in from somewhere, and it was very well trained.
I figured you would have found
a
way.
They had a racetrack there. They had a racetrack there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you see people out walking or exercising the racehorses. They were the size of American ponies, and they weren't very big at all. Horses did not do well. They don't do well in the tropics. They don't do well in rice. And they can't grow wheat there. And again, I think I'm probably diverting.
No, that's obviously okay. You were in charge of shepherding some of the celebrities around. You mentioned Ron Ely, certainly George Pard last time. What other celebrities did you come in contact with?
George Jessel, all too many times. The Miss America troupe, twice. Christy Linsel singers were there twice. Gary Merrill and Susan Oliver came. They were on a handshake tour, and I enjoyed both of them. Gary Merrill was very interesting. The Miss America troops and Christy Minstrel singers, they lasted all of about 3 or 4 days and spent the rest of the time in the hospital.
Explain that to me. What do you mean by that?
Well, it happened to almost everyone who came in the country. It took about 3 or 4 days, or within a week, they all had dysentery and heat rash and blisters and infections of various sorts.
Mm-hmm.
They just kind of, you know, zonked out. Dehydration, whatever. It was hot there. Very hot. Very hot and humid.
What would go into putting on one of these shows? How much work would you have to do to get one of these ready?
Most of the ones I did were smaller shows, and it was a matter of getting them scheduled, knowing what they had with them, if they were musicians, if they have equipment to haul. And with the Charlie Brown show, it took 3 helicopters, I think, to haul us and all of our gear wherever we went. So I was in charge of getting all that together and coordinating with whoever's going to meet us at the other end. Usually there would be an officer in charge that would take the people around and show them what we were doing. I had William Lundigan with me one time, and took him out to Fuji. And what happened quite often is they'd be taken in by the officers who would tell them what they were doing and the finishes and where everybody's thing was. And I get to, of course, witness all of this, so I probably knew a lot about what was going on militarily within 3/4 of these. Because they'd say, we had troops over here, you had a skirmish there last night, you pointed to places on the map. And it was interesting that I was taking people to fire support bases. And those men were right on the border of Vietnam and Cambodia. And so I knew that we were in Cambodia, and finally the Stars and Stripes newspaper, like 6 months after the fact, said, oh, the Americans, it's just been announced, the Americans have gone into Cambodia. We had been in Cambodia for at least 6 months before anything was told. I think I've diverted again.
Well, I was asking you what goes into putting on one of these shows. I mean, I assume that they tell you who's coming, what they're going to be there for, the people that are with them, and you're trying to find locations for them and making all the arrangements,
mm-hmm.
things like that. That sound about right?
Yeah. And making sure they were taken care of. Now, George Jessel was a total pain.
Why do you say that?
He had fallen off the stage somewhere, and somebody gave him a cane. I forgot who it was now. But he had this famous cane that he had to tell who gave it to him. It would be very famous. And he would wear this jacket with all kinds of metal, totally covered in metal. And he wore a toupee. And he always brought some cute little girl with him. And he would go out and, I guess, tell jokes. And usually the girls would sing, whatever. And he put on a show for the men. And he was there 2 or 3 times during my stint. And he was very sexist, made sexist jokes. I remember I went to the UFO place in Saigon one day, and he was in there and saw me. Oh, hi, he yelled across the room. Hi, Kay. How's my wife doing? And you know, just stuff like that, very insensitive comments.
Yeah.
And he had Melba Joy Moore with him on one of these trips. And, oh, Melba, my shoulder hurts. And she would massage his shoulder. And took them out to a fire support base, and she got off the helicopter, and her 3-inch high heel spike heel broke. So she's going one foot high heels and the other one barefooted, chomping around. And took her out to a base that had a lot of black men. And she disappeared for about an hour and a half. I don't know where she went. And while George Jessel went to take his nap, he had to take frequent naps because he tired very quickly. And one of these helicopter rides, very hot when you're on land, and as you go up in a helicopter, the air gets thin and it gets cold up there. Well, we went up in the helicopter, and he'd been perspiring, and the perspiration was running down his forehead and into his makeup that he was wearing, and also the cheesecloth underneath his toupee was showing. I just remember, you know, looking at it and thinking, oh my. He was very demanding. His favorite drink was Drambuie, and every time he landed on a base, the first thing he would request was his Drambuie. So he could be out on the Cambodian border, and the guys would be looking for Drambuie, and they usually came up with some amazingly enough. Oh, let's see. William Lundigan, he arrived drunk. They had to pull him out of some bar. And somebody was picking him up, and it wasn't me. And on the way from the airport, he stopped at a bar, and they had to pull him out of the bar. I took him down to Can Cove. And down there, the first thing you want to know is where's the bar. Took him out to a fire support base. And all the guys said, who is that guy over there drunk? Who is that guy? And he had taken his shirt off and sitting there in his bare-breasted signing autographs. And nobody knew who he was. He had been Captain Somebody in the early 50s, I think. So he was kind of past his prime. Oh, let's see. On the bigger shows, like the Bob Hope, we did not handle those. They came straight out of Bangkok.
Yeah.
And they usually came with 60 people or more. They had to be billeted where there was running water, flushing toilets, air conditioning. And because of the security, they were usually flown in the day of their performance and flown out the same day. And they did come in through Long Yen Post for one of those. I think that the day I knew he was coming, they don't tell anybody he's coming, but I figured I could kind of tell from what guys were saying, that, no, we can't take that celebrity on President's Day today. We're going to be busy that day.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I know they wouldn't be busy for anything other than something very special. So I kind of knew that the day he was coming in and I headed for the beach.
I was going to ask if you wanted to see it or you wanted to get away from it.
Yeah. I just wanted to avoid all the noise.
Yeah.
And complications.
Of course, yeah.
There were some things that were unique to special services. We had four branches. I don't know how familiar you are with all of these. But we had service clubs, craft, library, and entertainment.
Mm-hmm.
And I think all these positions required women to have college degrees. And most of the entertainment branch had graduate degrees. And therefore, we had... I was at NAF 9, and I think Brad was an 11, and Myers was a 12. Oh, GS is what they call it, GS 9, 11, and 12. So Mr. Myers, who was the top of our Saigon branch, and he would have been in charge of all the special services, entertainment people throughout Vietnam. He reported to the head guy, and he had a GS 12. Service clubs primarily were GS7 people. Some of them might have even been 5. I'm not quite sure where the college degree came in. I think anyone with a college degree probably had a GS7.
Mm-hmm. And you were, I may be wrong here, but weren't you the entertainment director for all of 3 Corps at one time?
Yes, and I kind of inherited that job. Brad had been the 3 Corps director. And he wanted to do a command military touring show. So he turned the 3 Corps directorship over to me so he could do his other.
Hmm.
But and he was closely supervising me, of course. And Brad was a wonderful, wonderful person. He was a thorough delight to work for. Really, and he had been over there for years. I don't know how many years. And he was definitely career entertainment director. He had been in other places as well. When I signed up, the only place I could go was Vietnam. All the European places, which I might have liked to have gone, were all 3-year commitments. So Vietnam was a 1-year commitment, which was kind of unusual. Usually, most of these commitments for career people were 3 years. And the idea was that we would go over and supervise the entertainment division of the Army. And they had a turnover every 6 months. They would get new people in, and you were supposed to just kind of oversee that and keep the continuity of the programs going.
So once you take over as entertainment director, how, if it does, your role change, your schedule, the things that you're responsible for?
Mainly, for me, it was that I got men to work for me and do some of the basic work, like I had Bert doing most of my assignments. And he would say, so-and-so will be here in these 4 days. And he would figure out what to do with them during those 4 days. And you kind of get contacts out on the field. And Oh, sometimes you call your favorite contact, or depending on who it's coming and what kind of a show they have, whether it's like George Sippard came over, he was the only one, he was a handshake tour. Ron Ewing, the same thing. So you have one person to escort. I escorted a lot of them. I guess probably most of them. Unless I, for some reason I couldn't, but I enjoyed doing that, so I did a lot of that. So I had Bert working for me. I had Tom working for me. Tom was such a talent. He was an extraordinary talent. But it kept him busy with shows. And the deal was, Tom, I know you want to do this. And when someone comes to me and says, where's Tom today? I have to have an answer for them. So keep me totally posted as to your activities at all times. And I was always being quiz. I don't see Tom here. Where's Tom? And I would tell them, well, he's working on such and such. He's over at the Vietnamese American Society or whatever he was doing. And he typically had some TDY men with him. So he was putting things together and keeping a lot of people happy. So really my job would have been more like what the men were doing initially. When I first came in, I was distributing these people, finding places to send them. And sometimes Brad would go with him. He was tired of doing it, so he got to where he was sending me most of the time. When he turned it over to me, I was just doing all of his work. He could do something different.
Did you like serving in this capacity?
Oh, yeah. And I had, what was really neat about this job, there were so many things that needed to be done. And as long as you got the things you had to do done, no one cared what you did in the other time. So I was doing all kinds of things. Of course, as women, we had fun getting our alleys made. And Jan had fun going to nightclubs and things where she would often sing, maybe sing Summertime or something like that. And another woman we spent a lot of time with, her husband was over there in Ford Motor Company. Who knows what he was doing? And she was just having a great time being a wife and wearing gorgeous clothes all the time that she had handmade. There were no places to buy clothes other than the commissary. And all the small sizes, I'm fairly small, but all the small sizes were rarely seen because the Vietnamese would get in there and buy all that stuff because they were small. So small shoes, small pants, trousers, shirts, all that stuff was gone. But my mother was very beneficial, and I ordered a lot from the Sears catalog.
Oh, is that right?
Oh, yeah.
So did you correspond with your mother pretty regularly?
Probably so. I furnished my little apartment pretty much out of the Sears catalog.
Mm-hmm.
And I tended my hair at the time, and my mother would send me all the hair tints that I needed. And anything else that I felt like I had to have.
Such as what?
Oh, books, I guess. Let's see. Well, on a typical day, breakfast, this is an office day. I get up in the morning, have breakfast at a local restaurant, usually within half a block or a couple of buildings from where my place was. Usually had coffee with mud in the bottom, and fresh papaya and French bread with weevils. And when I first arrived and got the French bread and saw the weevils, I kind of set it aside and passed right to the house. Within a week, I was eating the bread and picking out the weevils. I never got quite so nonchalant as many Americans in just eating the weevils and all of it. I usually manage to pick those out. I could walk to the office from where I lived when the office was downtown. Schedule celebrities and then entertainment in the field via helicopters. Let's see. Ida Berlin was there at one point.
Hmm.
I still. And she came in by herself, and she was going to have to be a handshake tour. And the guys decided that she needed to do more than that, and they tried to teach her to sing. And I guess they were somewhat successful. Oh, another thing I did, I adjudicated a lot of shows. We had groups from the Philippines and groups from Australia that would come in and do shows. And these could be hired by various support commands out in the field. And they were adjudicated to get their hiring price. And I frequently did that and did that locally in Saigon. I participated in command military touring shows. Sometimes we had entertainment contests, and we would have that in all the different corps. And it was a way of finding talented men who were there as soldiers. And Brad was doing this quite a bit, so we could find soldiers of talent and send them out as command military touring shows. And when we had these, they would have to have judges, and I frequently got called in to be a judge for those. I know I did one in Cameron Bay that I remember. That was quite interesting. Cameron Bay had a lot of blacks in, and there was a lot of problems up there, racial problems in that area. But when I was up there adjudicating, we had these groups of usually four men, a lot of them black, that would do the dancing, and what was really popular in those days, singing, dancing, and sync with one another. And a lot of talent came out of these shows. We picked up a lot of good people. One that I remember was a young man that sang and played his guitar, and he sang Call the Wind Mariah, was one of his favorite ones. And on a freight train, I'm leaving on a freight train, I've forgotten how that goes. And that was another one that was very popular and sung everywhere, I guess. Going back home, going off, whatever. We sent him out. And those were great shows because we could send him out in jeeps or just about anything. We didn't have a lot of, didn't have to send them on airplanes as we did with the big celebrity large shows. And we didn't have to get helicopters for them either. We could just kind of send them to local bases. And they were very popular because they were entertaining men just like himself.
Mm-hmm. What was the, I know this would vary greatly, but what was the attendance like for these shows? Whether it's a larger show or smaller show or just one guy going out, I mean, who would be attending?
As many troops as could get to them. They were very well attended. With George Jessel, and I had a group one time of three men and a woman. They were from the Denver area, I believe, and just kind of sang folk songs. The woman was gorgeous. And she was like the girl next door. And every man available at whatever camp we were on would be there. I had George Jessel one time, it poured rain, and the men sat there in the rain and watched. They got a cover to put George Jessel under, and had a mic, and they wanted the mic in the rain. But the men sat there for an entire hour or more in the rain. They had so little entertainment that it was a wonderful thing for them to be able to do. And then with the group that I had from Colorado, they had records that they signed and sold. The people bought those, men bought those.
You're talking about.
I would say they were very well attended, probably 90-95% attended of the available.
Well, that's impressive.
Yeah.
You were talking
it
about.
It depends on how busy they were.
Right, sure. Depending on what the enemy has going on as well as what they have going on, obviously.
Yeah, there were times when. Would you like to come down to the dugout they had that was covered with sandbags? Because we've got some incoming. I think they would call it possible incoming, but the men would be firing their. It's been so long that I've forgotten the names of all this equipment. They have this small little cannon thing. Some of the places have the great big howitzer. And howitzer shells were piled up in huge, huge piles. And the Vietnamese turned them into everything. That would be one of the positive things. And I have several of those souvenirs. One is a large brass vase made from a howitzer shell. I have a couple of ashtrays made from howitzer shells. some large candle holders that stand about 3 feet high, and they're kind of 3 or 4 pieces. Those are all made out of brass howitzer shells. And I have a bell that's maybe 6 inches high that I picked up that's made out of a howitzer shell. They were making all kinds of stuff with them. Clever people. And I have elephants that are pottery. They did very nice pottery work as well.
You mentioned possible incoming. Were you ever at a base or any place that was under attack while you were there?
Probably. They didn't broadcast that to the civilians. But they would say, oh, we're just practice shooting. I don't know why they'd have to practice. They were shooting at something, I'm sure. So I did get to watch them in firing these. I can't even recall what they called them. Took 3 men to do it. One guy fired it, one stuck the shell in the barrel, and they would have it down to where they were totally in sync, which was important because you didn't want it going off while someone was putting it in there.
I assume you're probably talking about a mortar or something like that, I guess.
Yes,
yeah.
Mortars, that's what it was. They were firing mortars.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You were talking about a song a little bit ago and dealing with all these entertainment types. What kind of music do you think of when you think of Vietnam? What sort of music do you hear today that triggers memories of Vietnam?
Oh. Rolling on the River? Vietnamese can't say R's. And Rolling on the River was a very popular song then. And if you went to a Vietnamese nightclub, you always heard it, and it was sung by a Vietnamese who called it Rolling on the River. Which I used to get a kick out. That was one of them. I'm Leaving on a Freight Train. I already mentioned that one. My background is not in popular music. Never even followed it as a kid. I was always into classical music.
Which is kind of where your education went, obviously. Did you ever get a chance to leave Vietnam to go somewhere else on a little break, on R&R?
Oh, yeah. 2 or 3 times to Hong Kong on a weekend.
Is that right?
I had 2 hours. Yeah, it was like a 2 hour flight or something. It wasn't a big deal. And
what do you think of Hong Kong?
That's a kick. I would shot myself crazy. They had a big PX there where I bought, where everybody bought the giant speakers, and I'm still using them.
Is that right?
Six-way speakers. Yeah, there are 6 speakers in this great big thing, and it's hooked to my television set, which isn't working right now. I bought a sewing machine there, and it was last year's model, but it was a great sewing machine, Singer sewing machine for, I don't know, half of what you pay in the States for it. And the speakers and jewelry galore. Oh, jewelry is so cheap. Ivory, which wasn't illegal at that point. And of course, nobody thought about it much.
Mm-hmm.
I certainly wasn't aware that they were killing off all the elephants to get the ivory. But I bought ivory bridges and ivory trinkets and bracelets and necklaces and earrings, whatever. That all of that. You get a beautiful pair of pearl earrings for $20. And a friend of mine bought for me a pearl necklace for 100 pearls on it, all perfectly matched. And I imagine he might have paid 20, maybe 50, maybe even $100 for it, who knows. It's been estimated at 3,000 here.
Wow.
I bought a string of green jade that I paid $20 for. So a long necklace. I bought lamps that I had shipped back to the States. The lamps were, I think, $4.50 a piece, and they're ginger jar lamps. And I bought it the last time I was there, and the last afternoon I only had hours. I was afraid I was going to miss my plane back to Saigon. I said, just ship it to America. And I thought, well, I'll never see those again. probably going, if they didn't show up about 3 or 4 months later after I got home, they did show up and they were in perfect condition.
I'll be darned.
Honest Chinese. And they, those little people worked so hard to make a living, and they were so conscientious.
Did you get to go anywhere besides Hong Kong?
Yes, I went to Taipei, Taiwan. Before I left, I was living with Diana, and I've forgotten her name at the moment. She was a Navy nurse, and she deployed right after I did and went to Taiwan to be a Navy nurse for 18 months. So I went to visit her, and that was fun because I had an escort. She had a house with roommates and housekeepers and so forth, and a car. And we did the Mongolian barbecue one night, and the night market where they had the dentist and everything. And the way you pick a good dentist there is you pick the one with the most teeth in his fishbowl. And he's in there working on people, standing on dirt, and he's barefooted. And we got to watch the snakes get peeled because they eat snakes there. Yeah, a lot of them. Tons of snakes. A lot of them are poisonous. And I also went to Australia. And in Australia, I wanted to do some horseback riding, so I found there's a list in the UFO, I guess it was the UFO place there. Found a list of places you could go, people who would take in people, soldiers and whatnot. And one of them actually requested a woman, so I called it up, and it's about 350 miles northwest of Sydney. Maybe northeast, I can't remember. Anyway, I went to a sheep farm and spent a few days on the sheep farm. And they did have a horse, so I got the horseback ride. And they had a sheep dog, and I got to watch the sheep dog work. My husband took me out and showed me how the sheep dog worked. And, yeah, I had fun. It was a nice diversion.
Yeah. How long will these trips last, typically?
I'm not sure about it anymore, but I think Taiwan might have been 5 days, but Australia, because it was farther, I think we got a full week there. Mm-hmm. And let's see, the guys working for me, mostly went to Bangkok. Tom loved women, so he went to Bangkok, and he rented a gal for a week, one with big breasts, if you like big breasts. And they corresponded for quite a long time, I think, for the rest of the trip. And of course, he was married and had a child back in the States. The draft was something horrible there. Nearly all the men over there, at least the enlisted men who were out in the field, were all drafted. And there was a Charlie Brown group. The fellow who played Snoopy had a master's in drama and had a law degree. He was 29 and he was drafted. Bert, who I kept in my office after the Charlie Brown deal, had a master's degree, I think, in drama. He was sent to the Cambodian border, and he saw a little ad someplace that said, "Chaplain needs help." So he followed that up and turned out to be the chaplain's assistant to get himself off the front line, and he got to move the palm trees in and out of the church on Sundays, and we thought that was a pretty good deal. And then we found him and pulled him into Saigon and liked him and was able to actually pull him off that tour of duty and put him in Saigon in our office. And of course, being in Saigon, I had my choice of any talent I wanted in Vietnam. If they could get there and if they could get reassigned to Saigon, they were in heaven.
Oh, no doubt.
And, of course, here's a guy drafted and has a master's degree out on the Cambodian border. He didn't want to be there. And I guess the sad part of that was that the men on the border were very, very young, the ones on the front lines. And the ones who are older could usually finagle a way not to be there. So what was left was all these young, young men. And one of them I took a celebrity out to, probably a handshake tour, and field off to do his handshakes, and I talked to some of the men, and one of them I talked to was really, really upset, and it turned out on his first mission into the Cambodian jungle, he had fired on someone because they had a neighbor attack. And the person he fired on, the helmet flew off and the long hair fell out, and he realized he killed a woman. And he was still blathering about it 3 weeks later. And I imagine he was maybe 18.
Wow.
And you kind of picture these 18-year-old men from the Midwest, probably went to Sunday school all their lives, and all of a sudden they're in a war zone and they're shooting women. It just, it's no wonder it blew their minds.
Yeah. What was your relationship like with the soldiers you encountered?
I would say very good in general. Of course, I traveled with the Charlie Brown Group for, we did 19 performances, so we were probably out on the road for, I don't know, 3 weeks probably. They were like brothers. They were very protective of me, which I appreciated. And I really enjoyed being with them. They all had a great sense of humor. Actually, when they got back, I invited them all to my little apartment that I had in the hotel where I was still living before I got into my villa. And I had, how many, four, six men in my little tiny room. I had two beds in there, so I guess I was on one of them and somebody else was on another, and all the rest were on the floor. And I said, well, at least I have air conditioning. Oh, air conditioning, we're all going. They were buddies.
Yeah. What about the troops in the field that you would encounter? What kind of relationship did you have with them? Was there much engagement? Was there much contact with them?
Not a lot.
Yeah.
Usually there was an escorting officer, who would usually be a lieutenant or something, and I would, frequently they would be with me during the entire time, showing me where, you know, leading us around so we would know where things were, and introducing us to people and whatnot. So I saw, and some of those were coming to find on, and one or two of them I actually met for dinner and did things with. As far as the men were concerned, they were an audience. It was pretty hard to really spend much time with them.
Mm-hmm.
And they were also enlisted. Of course, I was not allowed to fraternize with the enlisted men. So it was not encouraged.
I know that other ladies who worked for the Special Services, the club division, had a lot more contact than you have had in the entertainment division. I was just curious to see if you had much contact with them like this.
Well, they would have had a whole lot because they were with them in the Special Services, whatever it was.
Yeah.
Passing out ping pong battles and so forth. And some of them probably had good relationships. Of course, they saw the same men every day, so you would get to know them. And Happy Valley was kind of the only two service club gals I spent very much time with. Of course, I created so much trouble there that they probably hated me for it. I think I told you about that one. Now, I'm sure that, in fact, I think they told me they were allowed to have polite conversation, that they were not supposed to have any conversations in depth with them in there. And so it's probably different on different places, I would imagine.
Yeah. And every situation, every individual is going to be different, so it's really all about the context and the situation. Yeah.
And there were quite a few women who got involved with the enlisted men. And of course, that was a big, you heard about that because that wasn't supposed to happen. But it was like, ha, ha, ha. The officers didn't have a great reputation with the women. And sometimes the enlisted men were more human. And they were just people.
Yeah.
They were all just people.
What did you think about the war? As you're traveling around entertaining the troops, you're seeing a lot of the countryside, you're meeting a lot of people from the States, a lot of people who are obviously deeply involved in the war in a variety of different aspects. What kind of thoughts were you forming on the war?
It didn't take me too long to realize it was a political war.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, now we know that Nixon put a stop to the peace talks that were going on in April of 1969. I was there in August of 1969. So Nixon had just taken over as president. And he put a whole bunch of more troops in there. So that's the The war could have ended in 1969, but Nixon interfered with the peace talks. And troop levels peaked on April the 30th, 1969, to 543,400 men. And between 1969 and 1975, there were 21,202 casualties. Now, the war could have ended, and we could have not had those casualties. So it was a very political war. I never even understood before I got there why, if the French couldn't do anything with it, that the Americans thought they could. But we were over there making money, and you know, people were... And the officers, a lot of them, was toward the end of the war that I was there, Vietnamization was going on, and the troops were being taken out. And there was little honor among the leaders there, and a lot of the officers were just hanging around. They would re-enlist or whatever, go on another tour of duty, so they could stay there a little bit longer because they were going to retire when they went back to the States, and the longer they stayed there, the more they would make their retirement. A lot of that was going on. And some of these guys really were, you know, they really didn't want to do anything, including get rid of the uniforms. So, and then also I was aware that the soldiers who were wounded went back to the States, had it pretty tough. And nowadays you look back on how the VA, the veterans are treated, and they sent back to their families. The families are supposed to take the financial burden of it, of taking care of their sons. And you know, it's a huge cost to war. And in the war that's going on currently, which is very similar, I think, to Vietnam, and probably a political war as well, it still goes on. At least they're not drafted and made to go there. Now there are more wounded rather than dead. In Vietnam, they were not typically just wounded, they were killed. But now there's just a lot of wounding that's going on, and a huge cost. Of course, I was aware that this was my generation. This was my generation of young men. They were my age, and we wiped out 543,000 of them. No, we wiped out 58,000 of them. Young men mine at my age, marriageable young men, many of them. And due to our leadership here. When I went over, I was really very, I wanted to find out what our country did. I was very proud of being an American. I thought we were a lot of do-gooders. And I was very disappointed to find that there were so many casualties and so much wheeling and dealing and people who really were selfish and arrogant and there for personal gain. That was really an eye-opener, I guess. And I thought the war was, you know, to prevent communism from spreading. I don't think it was. I think they must have known from the very beginning it was an unwinnable war. But they still sent all those men over there. Of course, when you think about it, what is an officer when there's no war? He's unemployed. So they love war games. And I recall several sessions when I was watching two or three of high-ranking officers telling the celebrities what they were doing in the war. And, you know, it's a game to them. They weren't out there, and their children were not out there. They were just doing some relatively secure place, doing all this strategizing.
Seems that you came away from Vietnam with a less than perfect attitude toward American military officers, based on your experience.
Yes. I would say that's true. Personally, I had a wonderful time over there. Helicopters were fun. I enjoyed the men that I met there. The professionally. It was the first time I ever worked with adults. And I found that I was good at it. I was very successful and had many accolades and awards that were won there, especially the Parade of American Music. We have certificates and stuff from that. I enjoyed the people I worked with. I worked with some terrific people. I got to travel a lot. And Vietnam itself was a beautiful country before we poured up of war. And I've been back since. I went back, I think, in 2000 or 2001. It's a modern city now. But it's still a beautiful city, and all the trees that had died, nearly all the trees by the Vietnamese palace were dead when I left. And they're all back and thriving, and they're huge trees. The part I used to fly over getting out to the Cambodian border was nothing but like a desert full of pit holes with strange colored water filled up in the bomb pits. And that's all gone. That's all jungle again. I used to wonder why they talked about all the underground tunnels in the jungle. There was no jungle there. Well, there is now. And it was the Agent Orange that took it all away.
Mm-hmm.
Agent Orange is a whole other thing. Again, people making money. Dow chemicals, selling chemicals that were perfectly safe for humans. They only killed trees. And perfectly safe for humans, but we know they lied about that. The U.S. government lied about when we went to Cambodia. They lied about Agent Orange. They lied about how much Agent Orange they sprayed. And Saigon was one of the, Saigon, I guess you'd say west of Saigon, is one of the most heavily sprayed areas. And you can go there now to Vietnam and still see a lot of birth problems in children. Some of my friends, and who was a Kelsey, you might have interviewed her.
Mm-hmm. Yes, we have her. Yes.
And she got married to a soldier that she met there, and had at least one miscarriage, maybe two, but she decided she should not have children. Has not tried since. I've never had a pregnancy, so I don't know if it was bothered, if I was harmed in that way.
Did you have exposure to Agent Orange?
Pardon?
Did you have exposure to Agent Orange?
Oh, yes. We all did. I was in Saigon most of the time. That was one of the heaviest areas of exposure.
Any troubles? Any health effects from it?
Hard to prove. I have had breast cancer, but breast cancer is not one of the 22 cancers listed on the list. But we know why. There were no women over there, or very few. So the numbers were not great. So far, I haven't had diabetes, but many of my friends, I think, certainly more nearly have it. I think Anne might also, I'm not sure. She has other problems. I've had some kind of probably nerve problems, but my skin burns. That's been going on for decades, and it's been tested, and no one can figure out what it is. And, of course, even if you do find out what it is, it's very difficult to prove that Agent Orange caused it. It's almost impossible. And most of the doctors will not claim it for certain it was caused by Agent Orange. And Agent Orange does stay in, stored in fat cells, and it does stay with you for, I guess, ever. As far as I know, Nan Nala is in poor health. I don't know why. Jan Brantley, I'm not so sure of. And she's thriving in Ashland, Oregon. And for civilian women, we have no VA benefit. So that probably needs to be fixed. We did serve in war. We could have been hurt. There was definitely risk involved in being there. One of our theater groups, a hand grenade was thrown on the stage, and later, that was our Snoopy. He got medevaced. That was the 29-year-old that with the law degree.
Yeah.
Got medevaced from a knee injury received while just being in a play. nervous all around me. A bomb came in one night, hit the Chinese embassy about 2 blocks from where I live. Lots of Vietnamese soldiers on corners late at night. I did get, what's the stuff they spray? It burns your eyes like crazy.
Oh, mace or pepper spray or something like that.
Mace or whatever. They sprayed that quite frequently where there were problems going on. And usually there'd be some little Vietnamese guard who would say, you can't go down the street, so you go around it, but you could still kind of smell it, and you knew what was going on. Usually it was hand grenades being tossed at somebody. And there was a bombing in a theater at one point. I didn't happen to be there that time. but the Charlie Brown group, as we were flying over today, we did get some fire, and all the lights in the airplane were turned out. Flying was kind of a kick because I usually got invited up to be with the pilots. And going to Da Nang, I had been with the pilots during part of that trip. However, the planes did not have any seats in them. They were totally empty because they usually carried cargo. And when it was passengers in there, sometimes they had some benches and sometimes they didn't. I do remember being on there with a lot of Vietnamese, and they would have their kids and their goats and their chickens and their pigs and so forth with them in the airplane, being taken someplace. And they had no restrooms. They had a piss tube for the guys, but that wasn't too helpful for the women.
No, it would leave you wanting, I would think.
Actually, that was one of the big events when I was escorting people. The first question I would ask when I got off the helicopter, where's the nearest restroom? How long does it take to get to it? Andy Davis, who was very popular, I never actually met her because she was there in earlier times. The war was much more popular earlier. The time I got there, we were kind of getting the second class stars. But Andy Davis was well loved by all the troops, and she used the piss tubes wherever she went. And the men thought that was absolutely wonderful. So I wasn't quite that adventurous. But she was famous for it, and I guess probably still talked about.
Well, let's say it's August of 1970. You know that your tour is coming to an end here pretty quick. One question I have for you is, once you realize that your end of your tour is coming up, what do you think about your previous year? How do you feel about yourself? How do you feel about your work? All of it. And you've alluded to it in different places so far, but as you look back on it, seeing the end of your tour coming up, how did you rate it? What did you think of your experience at that point?
I had loved my experience over there. I loved the country. I thought it was just a lot charming. Even when we got out to the French plantations and things, they were beautiful. And the Vietnamese people themselves were very family-oriented, sweet people. Of course, they thought of us as being giants. And when I went back in 2001, they were all normal-sized people again. They looked, the whole population looked so much healthier. However, there were not too many older men, because I understand they were tortured and many of them killed. I did meet one who was anxious to take his shirt off and show me the scars of his retraining, re-education.
Right.
Personal gains, I think, were huge. When I finished there, I felt like I could do anything. Give me a challenge, I would love it. This didn't go too well in the States. One of the things I really missed when I got back in the States is I didn't want to go back to teaching. I had escaped to Vietnam for a year rather than teach. When I came back, I wanted to do anything to teach.
I was going
to
ask you just what your plans were. What did you hope to do, knowing that this was going to be the end?
I wanted to do anything but teach. That slipper just did not fit.
Yeah.
I felt like it was babysitting. And that just, I guess I'm too goal-oriented to deal with babysitting on a daily basis. Anyway, so I thought, well, okay, I've heard about sexual discrimination in jobs. I've had no experience with that because my first job was a teaching job other than my pipe organ job as church organist, which I just continued for 23 years altogether. So I applied to almost anything, but of course, Vietnam was ending, troops were coming home, unemployment was really high, unemployment. You know, there just weren't any jobs here, and we had all these people looking for jobs. And I auditioned at lots of them, and they wouldn't hire me because I was overqualified to do anything. That's what they all did. Oh, you're overqualified. I finally took out, and then I tried getting an apartment, and I couldn't get an apartment because they didn't, as soon as they heard I was unemployed and just come back from the war, they wanted nothing to do with me. Even though I promised to pay them 6 months in advance, they still wouldn't talk business.
Wow.
I had to have a job. So, okay, I finally got a teaching job. Private school from kindergarten through second grade or something or other, and they hired me, and I had a split shift from 9 to 11 and 1 to 4, so it was horrible.
Is this back in California?
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Private school, and it was at a church, and they started out as nursery school keeping the kids, and they didn't want to lose the income, so they just kept keeping the kids there, and now as they were opening up second grade, so they were like in their third year of it. And I was supposed to teach music and some of the kids and so forth, but it was very poorly run. The kids were coming from homes that mother dropped them off at 6 o'clock in the morning and picked them up at 4 in the afternoon. And some of them are real discipline problems, even though they were tiny little kids. Anyway, I got an apartment because I had a job. As soon as I got my, I moved into my apartment, I quit the job. Went back to the unemployment services. This is just not working for me. I'm overqualified. Give me something else to do. Well, I had saved up a lot of money because when you're in Vietnam, you're making decent money, and there's really no place to spend it other than R&R in Hong Kong. So
that's one question.
Crazy in Hong Kong.
That's one question I haven't asked you is what was the salary? How much money were you making there in country?
I think it was right around $1,000 a month or something. It was equivalent to what I was making teaching. It was slightly more. But then I worked time and a half for overtime, and I worked overtime all the time because there was nothing else to do. So I made a lot of money that way. So I probably made about 150% of what I would have made teaching.
Okay.
Something like that. Maybe 140%. Well, the economy is so different today, it's hard to even imagine. teaching, what was I making in those days? Maybe $10,000 a year. I started out at $4,000. No, I started out at $400 a month in 1964, my first teaching job. And of course, by this time I had a master's degree and 4 years of teaching experience, so I was making more than the average beginning teacher. And I think when I stopped teaching in 1975, I was making about $17,000 a year, something like that. Still underpaid. Anyhow.
So what's next for you, Kay, after you quit the teaching job?
Oh, well, I tried all kinds of jobs. One guy almost hired me in a printing factory to do forms for him, which I knew I could do because I'm artistic. And he said, you know, really, sincerely, if I hire you, I would love to hire you, but I don't think you'd stay here. And can you sincerely tell me that you would stay here? And I, for the salary, I probably would move on. And so what eventually happened was when September came around, I left Vietnam in August, and I traveled until almost December. I got home, I think, in time for Christmas, and then I moved from Southern California to go visit my aunt and uncle in Sunnyvale, California, Northern California. And said, would you mind company for a couple of weeks? Oh, sure, we'd love to have you. And 6 weeks later, I thought, I've got to get out of here. And that's when I took that teaching job so I could get into an apartment. The rest of the year, I took classes at the rec center and just enjoyed myself and looked for a job. And really didn't find any, so I did apply at two different teaching places hired me, one in San Bruno, which was local, and the job I had turned down to go to Vietnam was in a suburb of San Diego, and it was a really good job. They said they would hire me again, so I had, in fact, they offered me a contract, and I still hadn't heard from San Bruno, and I finally called them, and I said, you know, I really would rather, I've gotten a contract that I have 10 days to sign, I'm going to sign it unless you have an interest. I'd really rather be in San Bruno. And so they sent you a contract. I said, well, where did you send it? They sent it to KK Peterson, which was my married name. And therefore, it came to the apartment house where I was living, and no one by that name lived here, and they sent it back. And I hadn't heard. So anyway, they sent me a contract. So I went back to teaching, San Bruno. I had to take a second grade to get in, and then I went to fourth grade. I taught there for 4 years. And 4 years later, I thought, I really got to get out of teaching. And I was, I think, thought of as being a very good teacher because I was creative. That's what they people said. And since I was musical, I usually had the choir. I had the choir in San Bruno, too, where we did programs. And in my class, my fourth grade classroom, I always passed out recorders to the kids, and we played recorders a lot. And I always insisted on having a piano in the classroom, so we did, we would do the Pledge of Allegiance and sing a patriotic song every day. And if the kids didn't want to sing, they could play the recorders. So, you know, I had one really, really good year. I had only 23 kids in my classroom, and they were wonderful, but the rest of the time I had like 35 kids and more and more hyperactive kids as time went on. And we never had enough supplies, and things just never were very smooth. I mean, rarely had good support from their principals. They were too busy doing other things. Anyway, so I finally decided to take a leave of absence. And I took a leave of absence and thought, well, you know, I'm trained to be a musician. Why don't I just open a piano studio, which is what I did. And it kind of went okay until for a whole year. And I wasn't making really enough to continue this on. So I said, okay, I'm coming back. Well, the only thing they had to offer me was a third, fourth combination, and it was the, I forgot what they call it now, but we had lots of paperwork to do. And I thought, oh, that's going to be awful. And my stomach started just flip-flopping the other day, and I was really, really, really ill. So I thought, well, my body is trying to tell me that it doesn't want to go back. So I finally resigned. So I thought, this is just not going to work. And since I resigned, all the other music teachers in town gave me all their overload and filled up my studio. I was happily teaching piano for like 5 years. I loved it. Probably one of the neatest things I ever did. And I had like 30 students. So last year I taught, I had 7 adult students. And I really enjoyed them. But I had several children, kids. The first student I had was 6 years old when I took him in, and I had him all the way through high school. And he's now in the Foreign Legion. He's been very successful. In fact, I live near Hillsborough, which is a very affluent area. And about a third of my kids came from there. And they were families that really wanted their kids, supported them having music and brought them. And wonderful, wonderful kids. They didn't have, even as teenagers, they didn't have clashes with their parents. They were just so well raised. Anyway, yeah, I was paying the bills, but I wasn't saving a cent. So I finally decided, before I get much older, I need to get into a career. And again, I looked and looked. The employment situation wasn't quite so poor. And I finally got a job in the training department of Pacific Plan. I was there maybe a year and ended up doing, well, they finally sold Pacific Plan, but the new owner said they wouldn't buy it unless they had manuals on how to do everything there. Well, since I was about the only person who could write in the company, I ended up being a technical writer, and I think I produced 17 manuals. The company closed, and my boss, who was very successful, moved upstairs into the limited partnership area, and he was able to get me up there as well. And then I was there a while supporting some of the really macho male directors. And they moved me downstairs into the general and private placement center. They were putting shopping centers and apartment houses into bundles and then selling them. And I mean, they were like for $500 a share, and they're called limited partnerships. Limited to the owners who bought the shares, and they were in general. The general owners were the people there in the business who were making all the money. And Then they started, they had to bring some wholesalers in, and they brought in 6 wholesalers to train, and only 5 of them were there at first. And 3 women were hired to support them, and I was assisting the CEO. And I ended up training one of the wholesalers, and then they promised that they would have, and they were had various districts all over the U.S., and he had, the CEO had promised that he would send someone out to help them with their talks and so forth. And it ended up that I got to travel with most of them, so I was traveling all over the United States. They were making like, you know, $60,000 or $70,000, and I was making like $35,000 a year. And so I thought, well, you know, it can't go from here to there. It just didn't happen. One of the things I really loved about Vietnam is I was really free to keep myself as, you know, to do lots of things. I did posters and artwork and directed a choir, and I did my job there. And there were really no limits in what you could do. Whatever needed to be done, you just jumped in and did it. When I got back to the States, everything was regulated. You had a job. If you got outside the limits of that job, people pulled you in immediately because you were stepping on other people's area. I found that very frustrating at first.
Yeah.
And then to move from one level to the next level, you couldn't hop from here to there. You had to go through a good step at a time. Very political. So I left the job I had as the assistant of CEO at this partnership place. But by the time I had done that, I had gotten my insurance license, and I got that in the first training job that I had. And when I went downstairs, I had a 22, a Series 22. This is NASDAQ Series 22, the Cell Limited Partnership and Mutual Fund. And so I took a job with Waddell & Reed in financial planning and pursued my Series 7 stockbroker's license. And eventually I had enough clients that I had one out of state, and I got a Series 6, I think it was, maybe a 63. Anyway, I had all these securities licenses. And I did financial planning for about 5 years. But again, some of my work was on commission, some of it was on fee. And it was very hard for a single person to have a smooth financial life. And one of my friends came along that I had met in Toastmaster and said, our company just went public. We need someone to handle our stock programs. And since you have a securities background, why don't you consider it? And I ended up working for Imcon that had just gone public, and I handled their stock programs, employee stock purchase plans and stock option plans and insider reporting. And that's what I did the last 15 years of my working career. And I loved it. It was perfect for me. And I ended up, the last 8 years, I think I was consulting, and I was going around to, this is all in Silicon Valley here. I worked in like 21 of the different companies. Some were very short term. Somebody who couldn't make it today, can you cover? Sometimes it was a long term one. Taking a leave of absence, going to Europe with my parents, can you cover for 3 months? Or we need to train some people. I was at several places for 6 months or longer. And it was something different in a lot of the different places. Sometimes I was taking over the entire job. Sometimes it was doing technical writing for some particular project. Hewlett-Packard was one of those. Hewlett-Packard is one of the first companies to go into stock administration heavily. And since they had programmers there, they did their own programs. And they had them all over the world. And of course, in England, for example, if you give someone a stock option, they have to pay taxes on it immediately at whatever the current price is. Well, if the price of the company, price of the stock of the company goes down, they pay taxes on what it used to be worth. And they've already paid the taxes and they don't get the refund.
Yeah.
So they didn't want stock options. They had to come up with something else to, for incentives. So there were all kinds of different characters, animals, I called them. And HP hired me to write all of this out so that they could hand a book to someone when they could understand how to work with all of these different things. But I had all kinds of different assignments, and it was very interesting. And then I retired.
Well, certainly a very varied career in the types of things that you were doing. And finally getting away from teaching, it seems like was the right thing for you to do. It seemed to excel after
that. Yes, it was.
Yeah. Well, take me back to 1970 here briefly, if we can, Kay. Okay. What was it like, number one, what was it like to come home from the war? You'd seen it firsthand. You know that the protests and the everything that is the Vietnam War by this time going on in the States. What was it like to be back?
Awkward. I'm an only child. Of course, my parents didn't want me to go. They were glad that I was home safe. My mother, though, had remarried. She remarried in, 66? No. Not 1964. So she had been remarried for a while. I wasn't fond of her new husband. He was a nice person and all, but he, I don't know, he was very involved in Elks, and I was emblem of the Elks Club and all these different clubs. And one night I was home, and I really wanted to sit down and watch television. I didn't want to go anyplace. And he wanted me to put on false eyelashes and get all primped up and go with him to these meetings. And of course, wherever I went, oh, this is my daughter. And they would start, you know, going off into all these things about how wonderful I was. And I found it just very hard to take. The war was, I just didn't talk about it because nobody understood. There was just no way to really make them understand what was going on over there. And it wasn't pretty to talk about. And they were having the gay life back here in the States. Their minds were, on how wealthy they were and how many vacations they took and how much jewelry they wore and how many fun things they did. And it was pretty impossible to really take them where I had been.
Mm-hmm. Well, what about the war itself? Really, did you pay attention to what was going on?
Not so much because I was struggling to get back into civilian life again. I think first few months when I was trying to get a job, every day I was working on that, sometimes 4 and 5 hours a day just to find a place. And of course I had some recreation to do. And nothing too much had changed. I was working and teaching in San Bruno in 1975 when the war ended. Of course we were all aware of that.
What do you remember from that time?
I was working with fourth graders. The news was filled with what was going on at the embassy in Saigon. And all the history. And the guy who was there who didn't want to leave. And therefore, no one was prepared to really go. And the poor Vietnamese people trying to get out of there. The people who had connections in Vietnam, like my landlord, they had French and they had France and they had the United States they could go to. Whether they got their parents out or not, I have no way of knowing. But most of the people with any influence had passports to other countries. And they probably got out. And first, the United States got out some key people. But it was pretty awful. Glad that the war was over, finally. Of course, the end was probably inevitable from the very beginning. And as I said, I went back in 2001. The people looked healthy and happy.
Why did you go back?
There was a whole group of us. We had a reunion. The Charlie Brown group had a reunion in 2000 in New York City. They all met and got together. At that point, decided that many of us wanted to go back and see this gorgeous country that we had left.
I'll be darned. What was
and
it like
so
to go back?
Person. Different. I did go back to where I had lived, and I did knock on the door where my landlord had lived in the bottom unit, and someone answered the door, not anyone I recognized. And I did not have permission from the Vietnamese or the communist government to visit these people. And at that point in time, you needed to have permission, written permission, to visit any of the civilians there. They didn't really want us talking to civilians, I guess. And the lady opened the door for me, but she did not want to talk to me. And was not about to show me my unit that I had lived in, which I would have loved to have gone up and seen accident. So what was the question again?
I was just wondering about this trip that that you took back, what it was like to go back and see this.
The city was totally changed and it's modernized, which was nice. And we stayed in the Meyer Court. Well, I had lived in the Meyer Court when I first got there. We stayed in one of the big hotels. It's completely modernized. And we stayed in an old section, which was interesting. And had some wonderful food. One day I walked by the museum, and three of our helicopters with the teeth, the mean-looking ones that the Viet Cong hated so much because they were loaded with a rotating machine gun type of thing on each wing. There were three of them sitting in front of the museum with the same shark teeth on them and everything as I had seen all over Vietnam. And the pilots loved them. I guess they weren't helicopters, they were small planes, very fast planes. And all three of them had the communist insignia on it. There was no mark of any U.S. anything, and those were U.S. planes sitting there. Of course, we left a lot of equipment over there. That bothered me. Of course, communist flags were everywhere, which was different. The people looked healthy and happy, though. We have to give them that. And, of course, it was a whole new generation because it had been 40 years since I had left. 30 years. 30 years since I'd left, so a whole new generation was there. And they looked healthy. They were still riding bicycles and still a lot of piccolos and motorcycles around. We had some wonderful meals. The people were friendly at the restaurants anyway. And just, well, also, that trip was done by Rick Holland. Rick has a whole lot of films that he's trying to put together and has tried to sell about the Vietnam man military touring shows. And when he went over there, we had a film crew with us. And they were taking more film about our trip over there. And he has this thing all ready to go now, and several people have tried to buy it, but they want to buy it with total rights, and he won't give up the rights to it. And he has just, I don't know, refinanced his house twice to finance this whole thing, and so far it's not on the market. Too bad that it isn't. You might want to talk to him about that. I can get contact information. Would you be interested? Because he does have a whole film on this.
Yeah, well, perhaps we can do that, talk that over once we're finished for today. Well, let me ask you just... No, please, go ahead.
Anyway, he would like to get a contact with him. He after the war, he and his wife ran the drama department at Indiana University, I think, has a PhD in it. And he was one of the, he was in The Fantastic, which was one of our military plays. Which, so he was over there as a draftee. Anyway, I can give you a way to contact him, because it would be nice if his film could actually be seen someplace.
Sure, sure, of course.
So far, I don't think he's gotten much action out of it.
Yeah. Well, let me take this back to our Vietnam topic, just for kind of wrapping up purposes. Okay, just a couple more questions for you. You've and you've alluded to some of this before as well, but let me just ask you directly. I mean, you look back on this time, closing in on 50 years ago, your one-year tour there in Vietnam. What did you take away from it? What did your time there? How did it most affect your life?
It most affected my life. I think it proved to me that I could be very successful working among adults, which was an important step. What else? It gave me other views on the U.S. government. It gave me definite views on war. And if I got, I was interviewed by someone a long time ago, and her questions were getting very silly. and I finally just said, war is not fun, war is slaughter. It's one group slaughtering another. And we don't seem to do much with history, the history of Vietnam. I took a creative writing class, and I've written a whole bunch of stuff on Vietnam and my experiences there. And I had to explain what Vietnam was all about because the students didn't know anything about it. I mean, really did not know anything about it. You know, I'd heard Vietnam War, but they had no sense of, probably some of them didn't even know where Vietnam was. And now we're in the Middle Eastern War that we've been in for 17 years, I guess, as long as we were in the Vietnam War. So history just repeats itself, and it seems like it repeats itself about every generation. You think about when World War One was, World War Two, Korean War, Vietnam War. They're all like a generation apart. It doesn't seem like we learn much.
What about the...
As a people, we don't...
I'm sorry?
As a people, we don't seem to learn much.
Yeah.
We don't seem to pass information on from generation to generation. Maybe it's like my parents who never talked about the Dust Bowl. Maybe all the troops in Vietnam, when they had their children, didn't talk about Vietnam. I don't know.
Well, that was kind of the... what you're saying, it leads me to my final question for you. And that is, what do we take away from the war? What is the legacy of the Vietnam War? What does this thing mean in your eyes?
It means that our leaders are not always responsive to the people they govern. It means that people get into wars and conflicts, often for selfish reasons. Maybe more women in politics to help. I don't know. War games are not fun for anyone except the people running the war games. I think we can take away that we need to educate our young people more on history, especially U.S. history and world history. I don't think too much of that's being done. And of course, nowadays they're cutting. I thought it was bad in 1975 that we didn't have the money we needed to run the school. It's much, much worse now. And we're not educating our young people. I mean, don't think there's much chance of anything being learned from history if we don't educate our young people. And that doesn't seem to be a high priority. And another not high priority is taking care of, if you have a war, take care of the people who come back from it. If they had a war today, I don't think anyone would, hardly anybody would sign up for it voluntarily. Because we know that we're not treated well. And in my case, a lot of my friends who've had some health issues, and even if I proved that Agent Orange caused them, there would be no recourse for me. And whatever happened to Dow Chemical for selling those chemicals and harming a lot of Vietnamese people? There are a lot of deformed children over there due to Agent Orange. There are probably some deformed children here due to it, too. And sterile men who didn't have children, women who probably shouldn't have had children. No one's really owned up to any of that, as far as I know. And we see our industries who pollute water, pollute the air, anything to make a buck.
Okay, is there anything else you'd like to add to the interview before we bring it to a close?
Oh, let's see. I can't think of anything else. I've got a few little notes here. See if I find them. I've passed over. I don't know if I mentioned the transportation.
In what sense?
This has come under sexism. Once our office moved to the outskirts of Saigon, I had no way to eat lunch easily, and I couldn't get a ride. Every day a vehicle would load up with all the enlisted men and take them to a mess hall someplace and they would eat. And that did not happen for me. Usually there wasn't room. But also the mess halls were all enlisted men mess halls, and I was not supposed to eat there. I was supposed to go to the officer mess halls. So I ended up not really having lunch. And I'd have a big breakfast, go in and stay until about 2 o'clock when I got really hungry, and I would usually leave and just leave for the day. And I lost a lot of weight during that period. I got down to 100 pounds, I think, by the time I left Vietnam. I've lost about 12, I don't think, had probably weighed 113 or 15 or something before I went over. And when I left, I weighed around 100 pounds because I couldn't get any lunch. And that was because the sergeant wouldn't give me a car. And he said, well, I can't give you a car. You don't have a driver's license. So I got my driver's license. I had to have a military one, and I had to have a Vietnamese one. I first got them both. I asked for a car. I said, oh, I'm sorry. I don't have any vehicles available.
Hmm.
So that's kind of the way the game went. I think I covered just about everything else.
All right, then. We'll go ahead and bring the interview to a close.
Okay.